Okay, good evening. I'd like to call the Wednesday, March 27th, 2019 meeting of the Oceano Community Services District to order. May we have a roll call, please?
Director Gibson?
Here.
Director Villa?
Here.
Director Oplogo?
Here.
Vice President White?
Here.
President Austin?
Here. Would you all please join me in the flag salute?
Ready, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, so for agenda review, I think we're going to move item 5, closed session, down to right after item 7. We'll give the staff reports, board of directors reports, public comment, and then we'll do item 5 before we start on the consent agenda. If that's okay with everyone?
I make a motion we approve the agenda as amended. Second.
Second. All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Roll call.
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Villa?
Yes.
Director Plogo?
Yes.
Vice President White?
Yes.
President Austin?
Yes. Okay, so that moves us to item 6, public comment for items that are not on the agenda. Can anyone in the public want to address the board for any items not on the agenda? Okay, seeing none, we'll move on to special presentations and reports. And may I get the Commander Nichols? Sounds Obispo Sheriff's. I know. Sergeant Nichols.
Would you pass that on to the sheriff, please?
Yes, I will.
Good evening, everybody. Wanted to give you some general statistics for February for the South County area, specifically Oceano, rural Oro Grande, but most of these statistics pertain mostly to Oceano. And I will be happy to answer any questions when I'm done. We had 7 disturbances in the month. Those are typically arguing type disturbances where somebody calls and says that there's a disturbance. It could be a family, it could be 2 people arguing, things like that. None of those resulted in arrests. We had 186 proactive enforcement stops in the Oceano area. Those would include pedestrian stops, bicycle stops, vehicle stops, things like that that are all initiated by the deputies. Out of those 186 self-initiated stops, we had 17 arrests, which is pretty close to about 10%, which is statistically average for the amount of traffic stops or stops that they make, resulting in arrests. We had 5 incidents of trespassing. That would include some of the RV parks, private property, things like that. None of those resulted in any arrests. We only had 1 vandalism reported in February. Typically that's more, but I think the weather had a lot to do with it. And a lot of these numbers are probably subdued somewhat just because of the weather. We had 9 instances of mail theft, and seems to be a growing trend, and I would expect to probably see that on the rise in the coming weeks as the rain becomes less and less frequent. Weather becomes nicer. We're probably going to start seeing more of those happen. I would encourage everyone and your constituents to get a locked mailbox if you don't have one. It's just too easy for somebody to just walk down the street and open up a mailbox and take somebody's mail out of it. Very few of those we actually have any workable leads because there's seldom ever any witnesses. People typically call us after the fact. So none of those suspects have been identified. We had 18 theft-related calls, thefts from cars, primarily. We had eight reported burglaries, which is included in those 18 thefts. I don't have the exact breakdown of that. Typically, those burglaries would include a locked vehicle. So if the car is unlocked, it's a theft. If the car is locked and somebody breaks into it, it's a burglary. So that's how those are differentiated, and we don't have a breakdown for residential burglaries. I apologize, but I'm not aware of any occupied residential burglaries that have occurred any time in the last 6 to 8 weeks. We had 4 juvenile problems. Surprisingly, only one transient-related call for service. I know that we're getting a lot of movement, and that continues to be an issue for us. We had a meeting with some of our staff that are responsible for the homeless outreach and enforcement. We're trying to develop a plan where we can come together and figure out a plan of attack on how we're going to address this moving forward as things start to warm up and the rain stops. They're going to try to repopulate a lot of the areas that we've already cleared. We have mechanisms in place to try to prevent that. But again, I think I may have mentioned last month, we can't just move somebody off the property. We can't arrest somebody and just leave their stuff there because we're responsible for it. So it puts us in a difficult position. There's now case law that says that we have to safeguard their property. And so we're looking at a lot of other bigger counties and agencies throughout the state on what they're doing, try to develop a plan, find out what works, what doesn't. But we don't have anything definitive in place yet other than doing our extra patrols. And we're going to continue doing that. We still have our off-highway vehicle equipment here that I brought down to the station several months ago. We're utilizing that to patrol the levees and the beach access area from the levee to try to increase our presence and ability to contact more people and cover more area. So we had 2 domestic violence incidences reported. 1 arrest resulted in that. And 1 assault with a deadly weapon. I don't know the specifics about that. That could be anywhere from a stick to a knife to a beer bottle, anything capable of inflicting serious bodily injury. Nothing is on my radar about that. So I am encouraged. We did have a house down on Napomo Street that was a problem for us. One of my deputies in particular became a regular presence in that area and made several arrests coming from that house for drugs. Ultimately, he authored a search warrant. We served the search warrant. 6 people were arrested. One toddler was taken into protective custody by Child Welfare Services. And the house has now been vacated. The landlord evicted them, and the house is now clear. So that was a very good success story for us, and their proactivity on the part of our deputies, really being vigilant out there and trying to solve the problems in the community. So that's all I have, and I welcome any questions.
Well, thank you very much, Sergeant. Does anyone have any questions from the board?
Yeah, you said there are mechanisms to keep the homeless folks from moving back in. What are those?
Those are the extra patrols that we're doing. We're doing frequent patrol checks at night, during the day, in the early morning hours. We're actively contacting those who congregate around the laundromat during the daylight hours, and we're letting them know that they're not going to be allowed to repopulate the levee area, that we are going to take enforcement action. My instruction to my staff is that if you can offer somebody services and they're willing to take it, then we're going to do that to try to help better their situation. My experience has been, having done that in the past, that most of them do not accept the services. And so we are kind of adopting a zero tolerance policy when it comes to their activity if they're unwilling to accept any services or assistance. And so we are not going to give back the ground that we've taken. And so That's the bottom line. So we're committed to doing that.
Are you working with Five Cities Homeless Coalition or any of the other organizations?
I attended a meeting with Five Cities Homeless Coalition recently, and we had a brief discussion only because they were talking about the proposed project up on the hill off of Oak Park Boulevard. So we didn't have a lot of time to discuss that. We have talked to them. The problem with the Homeless Coalition is they have a little bit different standards. Most of their things are more longer-term residency. I don't know if that necessarily is going to apply to some of the population that we have. Last spring and summer when we went through there, we took homeless outreach, social services, several other support organizations with us when we went through the levee and offered assistance to these people, and not one person took advantage of the assistance that we were offering them. I think we contacted 22 people, and not one person took advantage of any of the assistance that we were trying to offer them. So I wish there was a magic pill, silver bullet, if you will, to the problem. But it's something that society is going to have to deal with as a whole. And we're trying to work with our partners and our neighbors here in Oceano to be vigilant, to report things so we can stay on top of it. And until we figure out a mechanism that will provide housing to their standards, I don't know what the answer is going to be. It may be evicting them from the property and putting their personal property into storage and giving them X amount of days to recover it or something to that effect. Orange County has a system in place because they've had a really bad problem in Orange County, especially around Angel Stadium, where they're going in with social services and homeless outreach, and they're advising these people that they're trespassing, they have to move, they have so many days to leave or find accommodations. If they don't, then enforcement action is taken. They collect their property and safeguard their property for a period of time. And if they don't recover their property, then it's ultimately discarded. But they're able to clean up the area. Because really what this is this is really an environmental issue, especially for us down here, because they're occupying an environmentally sensitive area. And I know how long everybody's been working on trying to get the levee cleaned up. And that's been 8-9 years in the making, and we're so close to getting that done. But it really is an environmental issue. I mean, we can't even go in there and fortify the levee under emergency circumstances, but they go in and dig holes and use it as bathrooms and discard syringes and trash. And everything that they take or steal, they discard out there. So it really is an environmental issue. And we're not unsympathetic to the plight of the homeless, but it's been my experience in Oceano, specifically in Oceano, that these folks are homeless either by choice or because of their substance abuse problems. They don't have the ability to get back into society because of their substance abuse. I don't know what the answer is to that either. I mean, the court has multiple programs in place for diversion and drug court and all these other things, but I don't know. I don't know. We're doing the best we can. We're trying to come up with a solution, but at some point we're going to have to take enforcement action. And unfortunately, the sheriff's office, that's our primary purpose, is to safeguard people's safety and property and take enforcement action when necessary. And a lot of times they turn to us to try to solve the problem. We're trying, and we're going to keep working on it, and I'm not giving up. So
thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Madam, if I might. So Sergeant Nichols, do you know the number of days that their possessions, personal property, have to be maintained in security?
Well, there is, I've heard the number of 2 weeks.
Okay.
And that excludes, of course, anything perishable that's going to rot or cause a problem. There's case law evolving all the time about what we must safeguard and how long we have to safeguard it. My understanding what they're doing in Orange County is they give them a three-day notice to vacate, and if they don't, they come back, they take enforcement action, they collect their property, and they keep it for 2 weeks. And if they don't recover their property, then it's discarded. That's my general understanding of what they're doing down there. But we're working on getting the specifics.
Okay. And the reason why I asked, because your board might consider a future agenda item, or, you know, especially if district staff can coordinate with sheriff's department staff. I know this issue is coming up in some of our other unincorporated communities as well. And some of the discussion is the CSD still, we have the garbage power. And do we have the ability to assist the department, you know, the sheriff's department in terms of if stuff is collected, which, you know, it may be personal property, but it's also garbage to the community or solid waste. But how might those of us who do have that waste collection power might be able to provide coordination with the sheriff's department in helping with this requirement to do security, to collect it, to secure it, and then if it's not picked up, is, you know, to send it off to the dump.
Where would it be secured?
Well, so those are all sort of the details that need to be addressed and stuff.
Or you know, some C-trains or Connex boxes in a specific area that can be secured and weatherproof, and or something to that effect. You know, an option might even be putting the only problem with putting dumpsters or roll-offs or something like that is the whole public's going to use them. I mean, I even thought about, well, maybe we could put something up on the levee where at least they'd throw away their trash instead of leaving it in the levee. Mm-hmm. But if you had something up on the levee, it would probably be more inclined to be used by the homeless population than your general public. But even if you put stuff off a creek or something like that, you know everybody who knows it's there is going to come and dump their refuge there and fill it up, and it'll defeat the purpose of it. So,
and so the point is as the sheriff's department is looking at how other counties and other areas are addressing the issue, you know, I want to make sure to.
I think it's a good idea to put on the agenda then.
Yeah.
Something in the future. Okay. We can see how we can help.
Yeah.
And this is where
and it really will take a partnership with everybody involved to really get a handle on this problem. And again, we're not unsympathetic to those who are homeless or for whatever reasons. And, you know, we don't want people to be homeless, and we want people to have a roof over their head. But those who choose to live that way because of their lifestyle, then we have to have a mechanism in place to deal with that. And we're working on it, and I thank you for bringing that up. And our community action team, which is Ron Slaughter and Toby DePue, they are teaching classes right now, so they haven't been out in the field much. That's why we've taken it upon ourselves here at the station to be proactive out there in their absence. But we met with them a few weeks ago, and we're going to have another meeting coming up here in a couple of weeks to try to I don't want to say finalize a plan, but at least have something more concrete that we can let you know what we're planning on doing.
Are they, are they, those two CAT team, are they for the whole county?
They're for the whole
county.
Mm-hmm.
So they go, so
We have issues in the San Mario Riverbed as well, and so we that doesn't affect you here, but it's everywhere. It's in the Salinas Riverbed in North County. It's at the coast in Los Osos and Cambria, and it's here, and it's in the riverbed in Santa Maria. Last time I was in the riverbed, there was 6 people living underneath the bridge, the 101 bridge at the riverbed. Caltrans is great to work with because we just tell Caltrans about it because that's their jurisdiction, and I don't know what they're doing, but they come in and take care of it. So...
Well, thank you very much,
okay.
Sergeant Nichols. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
All you guys.
You guys have a good evening.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Okay, so let's go back to Field Supervisor Tony Martino.
Good evening, Board. Tony Maricino. All right, Lopez is currently at 58.4% full, which is 28,840 acre feet. We've had zero SSOs for the month of February. Still taking no state water, but that's due to change here shortly. Lopez has delivered 358 acre feet. We've pumped 303 acre feet. Just want to give you a reminder, Day of the Child is April 7th for everybody who wants to, who's going to attend at the community center. So as for work orders, we've had 18, 14 USAs, 13 customer service calls. We had 6 after-hours call-outs. One of them was for 444 Pier. Was a broken spigot. They needed the water shut off and get it repaired. We had a hydrant get hit at 2300 Cienega, and that is all getting reimbursed. We had a power failure at the yard during one of the storms a few weeks ago. Fairgrove Elementary School had a an abandoned water line that was used previously, years prior, and basically we lucked out and got to shut a valve off because it's no longer in service. But that was leaking one of the weekends. We had after-hours unlocks. We had a sewer backup on Utah. We continue to do valve turning, and the valve turning for the system is complete, so now we can go ahead and start looking at directional flushing the system to get it a little cleaner so when hydrants do get hit or things do go wrong, we don't have so many dirty water complaints. We're out of the drought for the most part, you know. A lot better off than we were years past, so we will be doing directional flushing. As for trash pickup, the 311 app for the month of February, we had 42 tickets that were sent to us. So quite a bit of trash. We had an upgraded meter on 1929 Wilmar from a 5/8 to a 1-inch. The hydrant at 2300 Cienega is reinstalled. We already concreted it back in. We had door hangers, meter changeouts, lock-offs, meter reads, highs, lows, leaks that we had to notify the customers after meter reads. We met with Cannon regarding system water loss, got a better understanding of that and where we're at, and working on that to get a more accurate depiction of our system. Weed abatement at the yard and around some of the sample stations. Jason and Doug did a confined space training that was free. It was down in Ventura with California Rural Water. They got to attend that, which was really good. Doug has not been to a confined space training yet. We had an APCD inspection, passed with flying colors, no issues. And the Air Park Bridge opened last week.
Yeah. I keep forgetting going around.
Yeah. It is open. Any questions?
So is this what you're talking about?
Yes, yes, that is the locations of the trash pickups that we've had from the 311 app. And just a reminder, the 311 app has been temporarily shut off due to we have a trash pickup with the trash company next month. I don't know the exact date off the top of my head.
1st to 5th.
A cleanup week.
1st to 5th.
April 1st to 5th.
There you go. And then it'll be reinstated after that.
Okay.
The 311 app.
Well, this is great.
And then
did
you mention that Jason and Doug finished valve turning?
Yes. I mentioned it's completed. Valve turning is completed, and we'll be doing directional flushing here shortly within the next month and a half or so. We just got to map out how we're going to flush the system. It's got to be done a systematic way, and I got to take a look at the atlas and go through that. We'll be isolating with valves and then really cleaning each line.
And sort of I'm going to put a point of emphasis because, you know, in the sewer system, when we do flushing, it all goes down the sewer lines, makes itself to the sand district plant, and nobody notices the difference. When we flush water systems, it goes onto the streets. And so People are going to notice water going down the gutters, and you know it's going to find its way into the ground and back into the groundwater basin and everything else like that. But a lot of agencies curtailed water system line flushing during the drought. And so what Tony is saying, he's got to pick it back up again. It's amazing what you can actually find in water pipelines. They've opened up breaks to find 2x4s in them. It's kind of like, how does a 2x4 get into a water system other than maybe when somebody was actually putting something together back in the day? But the sand and stuff that you find in a water system often is just because of the pumping activities. You know, when we pump groundwater, some of the sand comes in, gets into the water supply, finds itself into the pipes, and it settles down. So there's a number of different reasons that you can actually get, you know, some dirty debris in the water system. Of course, everything's chlorinated, so the water is still clean. But Tony's got to get in there and flush it out, and we do then see water that's going down the street. So they've got to also make sure that they take care in low-lying areas to make sure water doesn't go into a garage or, you know, something else like that. But I wanted to make sure to emphasize that a little bit in case board members see anything or if you get questions from the community about, you know, what's going on. It is a standard practice, but again, a lot of agencies curtailed it during the drought.
It's been a while since we've seen it.
The other follow-up item is on the 311 app. You know, the success is that we're getting a lot of participation in it, so we're able to respond and everything. But there also might be a couple of cases where people may be abusing it, where they take stuff out of the house, they put it in the alleyway, they take a picture of it, they send it to us. And so what we did is, yeah, of course, you know, you always find these things happening. And so when we talked about it at our last staff meeting, you know, we do have an on-call contractor to help us, especially during the big weekends and people are coming off the dunes or whatnot. And so if we pick up, you know, if we're suspicious that something nefarious is happening, we can, you know, call the on-contractor so that they can open up the bags, look for mail, look for other indications of who may be doing the dumping. We had that case about 2 years ago where there's a significant dumping in one of the alleys, and the perps had left trophies that they had won in bowling or something like that. So the sheriff's department was able to follow up with them. And so, again, success on the 311 app. But when we see certain things reoccurring around a specific property or whatever, then we're going to have to take a closer look at what's in the bags and everything.
I have a question. What is confined space training?
So confined space is anywhere that is not meant for permanent work. It has limited entry and egress, and the air quality could be compromised. Giving an example, our lift station is a confined space entry. Manholes, as you go into the sewer system, if you got to reroute them, that's a confined space also, because it's not meant for permanent working environment. Yes.
Thank you. And then to follow up, the cleanup week is the 1st through the 5th. And just a reminder to call South County Sanitary with your bigger items.
Great. Thank you, Mary. Okay, any other questions for Tony or any other comments?
Yeah, I have one question. When you're flushing the water lines, are you using just how do you open them, the hydrants, or do you open, where do you open them, various places?
Correct. So give you an example. So you got a main line. You isolate it to where it's only going one way, so there's no other lines feeding it. You're basically pulling from one end.
Yeah.
You open up the hydrant, and you got a diffuser, dechlorinates. And then as that water gets clean, the next team up, it kind of like a bound and overwatch, the next team opens this one up and then closes this down, so that velocity never stops.
Mm-hmm.
So it's constantly picking up the sedimentation, putting it out, and then the group who shut off goes to the next hydrant.
But you're using hydrants?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you need that velocity to pick up any of the sedimentation and get rid of it.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Like you do in Halcyon regularly?
Yes, but that's for a different situation.
That's because it's the end of the line.
It's an end of the line, and it's also a 12-inch main for about 3,000 feet that only 3 homes are on. So that's it. So it's the same concept, yes.
Yeah.
But just to clear, in those situations where we have dead end lines, it compromises water quality.
Yeah.
And so we have to open it up in order to get the water flowing
and we do
make sure we don't get stagnant water.
Every 3 to 6 months.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Very good. Thank you, Tony. Okay. Chief Lieberman, you're here. You want to give a report now, or do you want to wait till we're on the fire authority? Or go ahead.
Good evening, Madam President and Board. Steve Lieberman, Fire Chief. Just very briefly, don't want to steal any thunder from Mr. Ogren. I think the most relevant thing to share with you is our fleet status. It's been one of those weeks for me as the administrator. Good news is our Fire Engine 1, which is currently our first out rig in Arroyo Grande, should be back in service tomorrow. Currently, our heavy rescue is operating out of Arroyo Grande, which gives us pause because there's no fire engine in the Arroyo Grande station, so that will be resolved tomorrow. Engine 4, which is our reserve engine that sits in the station, will actually be driven to Paso Robles for some pretty straightforward repairs, dropped off when Engine 1 comes back. So that's good news. I did visit Truck 5 when I was in Paso Robles this morning. It is having a motor replacement. That's a large-scale job, as you can imagine. We should see the truck later in April. So I think I'll leave it there unless you have any questions, and then enjoy Mr. Ogren's report.
Thank you. Any questions for Chief Lieberman? Anyone?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Okay. General Manager Pablo Ogren, do you have a report?
I do, Madam President, members of the board. The extension of the Memorandum of Agreement on the Five Cities Fire Authority has been approved by all the managers. That's going to be a topic of one of the agenda items, so I won't get into it anymore right now. Today we submitted the project information form in response to the county's call for projects, the 2019 grant program under the Integrated Regional Water Management Program. So that was due today, and we submitted the project information. I understand from brief discussion with the county that there was 14 submittals, which means for the $3+ million, it's going to be very competitive. And we submitted two projects, both on Highway 1, that are associated with 2-inch galvanized lines and part of our water resource reliability projects. And so Director Gibson is on the team that's going to be evaluating the proposals. On Wednesday, the 3rd, next week, then, I'll have an opportunity to do a 2-minute presentation on our submittal, so in front of the Regional Water Management Group, so I'll do that real briefly. We did post bid documents for the utility relocation projects associated with the county's Highway 1 drainage project. Originally, the bid opening date was going to be tomorrow. The county had some addendums, and so they deferred the bid opening date until next Thursday, the 4th. So we posted an addendum to defer our bid opening date as well because we wanted to make sure it was at the same time. And the good news is that means that we'll have no need for a special meeting next week because after bids are open, we have a 10-day period in which to inform the county of whether we're going to implement through our bid project or if we're going to want them to implement through their bid process. So the board meeting of the 10th of April is going to be within that 10-day period, and we'll be able to have that on the agenda and avoid the need for a special meeting. Nicole had contacted each of the board members to look at possible dates, but again, that won't be needed. As Tony mentioned, Day of the Child is coming up on the 7th, and I'll expand a little bit more. Nicole gave me some notes because Nicole's been coordinating a lot of our efforts, but this year looks like it's going to be a really good event, and for those who are listening, it's from 1 to 3:30 on the 7th at the Community Center. And there's going to be 35 plus or minus exhibitors, which is an all-time high. Parks and Rec, the District Attorney's Office on Victim Support is going to be there. There's going to be some Zumba people and some stationary bikes. There's going to be no candy because it's a healthy day, remember, for the kids. Celia and Nicole is going to be representing the administrative staff here. Doug and Tony are going to be representing the office staff. And I know that Vice President White and Director Raplogle are going to be representing board members, so we're going to have a good show there all together. Supervisor Compton, his office has indicated that she's going to be there, and the promontories are going to be there as well. So it's going to be a good group of overall attendance. Just reporting on a little bit of activity that Carrie is continuing to follow up with the community coalition established by Habitat for Humanity, and they've had some continuing ongoing discussions regarding the community garden, although it seems like they need to get a team together in order to figure out how that's going to work, but it's one of the priorities that they've identified for wanting to implement this year. I just reviewed also, Carrie did the CPI adjustments, consumer price index adjustments for the water rates that go into effect in the billing period from May to July, but we have to notify all of the customers 30 days before, so that notification is going to go out in the bills this week. And the CPI adjustment, which is an average for 2018 of the LA index and the San Francisco Bay Area index, and those two averages at about 3.8%, where the Los Angeles area was about a 3.3%, but the Bay Area was about a 4.4% consumer price index change. Also, Nicole's been leading discussions with Lucia Marr Unified School District regarding the use of the community center for recreational activities. We met with Cienega Seabreeze to and had actually a really good discussion with them on issues that have been on the board's agenda, but how we're going to move forward. And then, as already discussed, the use of the 311 app is proving really beneficial, although some issues to look out for in that application. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Anyone have any questions?
Not right now.
No.
No questions? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Oberlin. We'll move on now to Board of Directors and Outside Committee Reports. So we'll start with Director Villa. Do you have? Mm-hmm. Okay. Director Gibson?
Yes. On March 6th, I attended the Water Resources Advisory Committee. And General Manager Ogren already mentioned the grant monies, that $3 million. So that was discussed. And then they also discussed a stormwater resource plan that also has some grant monies. And the intent of that is to encourage the use of stormwater as a resource to improve water quality, reduce flooding, and increase water supplies. And then they had election of members. It was a short meeting. And then on March 21st, I attended the Zone 3 water meeting. And because of the recent rains, the cloud seeding and low reservoir response plan were both postponed. And everybody's happy and smiling, but they all want people to use water as if we're still in a drought. So conservation is the word. And then the interesting thing we discussed was that at the Lopez Water Treatment Plant, they have a history of seasonal taste and odor issues, and also the algae blooms. So currently, they use powder-activated carbon for taste and odor, and they use copper sulfate and peroxide for algae control. So in order to come up with something new to address these issues, staff has proposed the use of floating solar panels. And you can pass that around to the public, too. It would be a power purchase agreement. In other words, no cost to us. It would be installed, maintained, and removed by the company. And the solar panels would provide energy for running the plant. If successful, then it might be possible to use less of the carbon, copper sulfite, peroxide, etc. So essentially that'll be continued. That's all I have.
Okay, thank you.
Cool.
Let's see, Director Rapolo, do you have any?
Yeah, I attended the Oceano Advisory Council meeting last Thursday. We considered two referrals. One was for a new house on vacant land near the beach and airport, and the other one was for affordable housing. It's actually It's on the Ready 311 map, this most eastward red dot here. It's very close to my house. I reported that dumping, and I also recused myself from considering that property because it's so close to my house. But it's, I believe, eight small houses on a very large lot. With eight.
14,
was it? I don't know. Somewhere between 8 and 14. small houses on this large lot, so might reduce the dumping if they put that in. And then we deadlocked. There were only four members in attendance, and we deadlocked on revising the bylaws on how at-large members gain membership. It was written unclearly in the current bylaws, and we weren't able to agree on how to remedy that. At the same time, there were two candidates to join the council, so it was decided to set aside the bylaws in order to consider those membership applications, which were both approved. So Mary Lucy and Cheryl Gardner have joined the council. That's all I have.
All right, thank you. Vice President Mark, do you have a report?
I had a Five Cities Fire Authority meeting, but it was a closed session, and I obviously can't report on it. But it will come up in open session soon. Thank you.
Okay. I will report on the South San Francisco County Sanitation District. Our last meeting, regarding the redundancy project, we approved the contract with Michael Nunley and Associates, and this is the agency that provides the administrative services, managing the consultants' work and responding to the data needs and ensuring the permitting requirements are met, supplementing our current staff. And so they do the administrative part, and then they will help do the RFPs for the construction part. So it's planned to be a 2.5-year project, $27.9 million. The final plan should be ready in April, and construction's due to start in fall of 2019. So I don't know, you know, we always talk about redundancy. I don't know if anybody's familiar with exactly what we mean when we're talking about redundancy, so I was just going to give a brief. And what it is it's like a backup. So the intention is provide backup to allow some of the major units to be removed from service for maintenance and repairs without violating of the effluent permit limits. So like we'll be adding a whole new secondary clarifier and a fixed film reactor because we have one, and if you can't take it offline without having a backup. So the redundancy program is a very, very important program to keep the plant operating in the best condition it can. And let's see, on Central Coast Blue, the staff's continuing to work on the technical efforts, providing data for the environmental impact report. And we're right now are conducting laboratory tests on the treated effluent. And I think our administrator has been meeting with other officials and working out on some of these plans. And as far as the numbers in the plant, they're all good. There's been no violations in the last 2 months. This is a two-month report because I wasn't here. So at our last meeting, there've been a lot of public comment. A few people in the public have been asking for a while for us to consider going to a five-member board. And, you know, right now it's three members. The three-member agencies each have their representative, the two mayors and the president of the Oceano Community Service District. So we did have a discussion on it, and we decided that it was something we did not wish to pursue at this time. And one of the reasons that the public thought it should go to a five-member board was that the board is too constrained with three, that you can't talk to each other. And the way we looked at it was we'd rather have all of our the meeting done at the meeting, all of our deliberations, everything done in the public, and not have two people that would talk out. And, you know, everything we do is done open in the public and in the interest of transparency. So another reason was it was just it would be trying to decide where you would find the other two. Would it be someone from one of the other town, the cities? So then you might dilute someone else's representation. And we just decided that there's a lot more important things going on right now to consider taking that on. And our audit for the fiscal year 2018 was filed, and it was a clean, good audit. That's about it. If anybody ever would like to go and tour the plant, you know, our administrator is happy to give tours and show any citizens if they're interested in the operations. It's pretty interesting and can learn about the redundancy program, too. So you just give a call over to the sanitation district, and they'll be happy to show you around. That's my report. So is there any public comment on special presentations and reports? Okay, seeing none, then we will move to our closed session.
Okay. President Austin, would you make sure that no members of the public want to take public comment on closed session?
Is there any public comment on our closed session? Okay, seeing none.
Pursuant to Government Code 54956.8A, the board will move to closed session to have a conference with legal counsel regarding the lease of real property by or for the local agency to grant authority to its negotiator regarding the price and terms of payment for the purchase, sale, exchange, or lease. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Okay, we'll now adjourn to close.
Estimated time is no more than 10 minutes, so we should be back here at 7 o'clock.
Okay. Closed session, please.
The report out of closed session is no reportable action.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I want to ask again now. I think we, seeing as we have the people here for the fire report, that's item 9.
We're going to do item 8?
No, we're going to, I'm going to move it. Item 9, I'd like to see if the board would be willing to do item 9C. The status update on the Five Cities Fire Authority. We have people in the audience. And do that and then go back to item 8A and the rest of the agenda.
I agree.
Yes.
Okay. So with that, then we will start with our business items of 9C, which is status update on amending the Five Cities Fire Authority Joint Powers Agreement and Board Direction as deemed appropriate. So you're going to give your report first and
yep.
then we do public comment. All right. Okay.
Madam President, members of the board, interested parties in the future and success of the Five Cities Fire Authority, welcome for being here today. What I want to do is the introduction is just doing a real quick recap of some critical dates coming up. And then there's about almost a dozen bullets in the agenda material on next steps. And I just want to walk through those one by one and encourage board discussion on those. Those bullets I shared with Chief Lieberman and the two city managers at our meeting earlier in the week, I think Monday, in order to get a little bit of feedback as to whether those bullet points sort of cover the bigger umbrella of our efforts that are coming up. But even before getting into critical dates, I think board members and the public is aware of the fact that there have been recent meetings both at Five Cities Fire Authority, the board most recent update there, as well as at the city councils. And it's sort of in one of these multi-agency efforts. It's just the time where it came for people to see how well are we really moving forward on these potential JPA amendments. And in fact, on one Sunday particular afternoon, we had elected representatives from the county, Supervisors Pichong and Gibson, as well as President Austin and Director Gibson, the mayors of Arroyo Grande and Grover Beach, and another city council member from Arroyo Grande, a bunch of staff, union representatives, and really had a good discussion about where are we at and where do we think we're going to go. So I'm going to reflect a little bit of that as we move through the presentation. But again, I think that it was a really positive outcome in terms of the communities recognizing that all three communities are important for the long-term success of Five Cities Fire Authority. We, subsequent to that meeting, the extension that was included within the memorandum of agreement was approved. Our deadline for having JPA amendments would have been coming up in a few days, April 1st. The MOA provides for a six-month extension, so that means our new deadline is October 1st, where we must have Five Cities Fire Authority JPA amendments done. The intent is to be earlier with respect to funding formulas and service levels, and then later in the six-month process is where we'd be doing T-crossing and I-dottings with respect to some of the provisions. We do feel like we've had good progress on the funding formula, and we hope that in the near future we're going to be able to make that presentation. Concurrently also, we're discussing the 1920 budget and recommendations that really need to develop quickly so that the Five Cities Fire Authority budget for 2019-2020 can get established. In the unlikely and what would be very unfortunate event that we did not have an adopted amendments to the JPA by October 1st, then the Five Cities Fire Authority is essentially dissolved. I don't know if that's quite the right word, but as it exists today, it would terminate on June 1st, 2020. So we know the importance of making sure that we have the adopted amendments done by October 1st. And on October 22nd, we didn't know this when we made recommendations on the JPA, on the MOA. But the primary ballot's been moved up from June, when California normally has it, and it's going to be in March of 2020 this year. And so the last day for an agency or a board such as yours to call for an election or a ballot item on the March 2020 ballot is October 22nd. So it's a little bit coincidental because, again, we didn't know that the primary was going to be moved up to March when the MOA was adopted. But October 1st, we have to have the JPA amendments done. And then no later than October 22nd, the call for a special tax election would have to occur. So obviously early October is going to be some big meeting dates for your board. And my last bullet on this slide is that even with JPA amendments, we need to anticipate that they will likely need to address what happens if the March 2020 ballot item for Oceano does not pass. So that's going to be one of the details that we're going to we've already started to discuss. And again, myself working with Chief Lieberman and the two city managers are working on developing some joint recommendations on that and the other details associated with potential JPA amendments. So I want to pause real quick to see if board members have any questions at this portion, because the remaining slides are really just taking the bullet points associated with next steps one at a time for to make a few statements and encourage board dialogue. And there's no action tonight. But again, we need to really start thinking about what our next steps are going to be. And so I'm going to pause again to see if there's any board questions.
Are you talking
at this
about
time.
The bullets, page 31, that, those bullet points that.
Yeah, we label. I labeled them next steps.
Next, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
got
I
it.
Think.
The only question I had on the next steps is, are those in order? Or
No, they're not in a chronological order. And I reordered the slides a little bit to be a little bit more chronological, but that even doesn't work because some of the efforts are going to be parallel efforts. So what I thought was is we would just kind of go through each of those topics one by one and have some discussions on them. Well, right up front, the first is a review by legal counsel with the board on applicable legal issues relating to the elections. And so that's really the do's and don'ts, right? We know the basics that we're not allowed to use public funds to advocate for either a yes or a no vote. But beyond that, there's a lot of details. And it's, you know, what our board members as elected officials allowed to do as you're going and talking to constituents versus what are we not allowed to do, because as an elected official you generally have more liberty. I'm a paid member of staff, so there's you know, I'm prohibited from doing a lot of things. Also, when you call for an election, arguments for and against, the statutes have some rules about what governing boards are allowed to do in those situations. But before we get, you know, too much further down the road, we want to make sure to have a sort of the primer training sessions on legal do's and don'ts and some of the applicable
statutes.
So you're
not going to do that tonight. You're just telling us what's coming
right
up.
Okay.
I have a question.
Sure.
And I think we need to know as soon as possible things like, do we as a board, do we need to individually start looking for money to support? Help this? Do we need to get committee people? Do we need to get our friends lined up to walk precincts, so to speak, although there wouldn't be any precincts particularly? But I mean, but how involved do we are we able to do to drive this thing? Because I think we need to start that as soon as possible. You know, it seems like a long time, but it's a month, it's a year.
So
to voting day.
And maybe if I can, so first off, thank you, Vice President White, because that's the kind of dialogue, you know, what are the questions that jump to the forefront of your minds?
Yeah.
And if I might attempt to restate that question, how involved can board members be with respect to, you know, an advocacy on a position?
And when?
And I think when is important because once you do call for an election item, the rules do change. And so, again, so the question I'm jotting down, how involved can board members be and when? Also, even after tonight's meeting, if board members have, you know, questions that pop to your mind on any of these topics, the best thing to do would be email me, and I can coordinate with Jeff on some of these.
And I have another question. Do we, and maybe this is all premature, but do we wait till October 1st to call for an election, or do we start saying June 1st we're going to call for an election and go ahead of ourselves? Because October, November, December, January, February, March, and you lose Christmas, you lose the month of December to anybody listening to you. I don't know.
So we know that our deadline is October 22nd.
Yeah.
You know, generally speaking, we're going to want to get as much information, as staff, we're going to want to get as much information to your board discussed as we possibly can before calling for the actual election. After it's called on October 22nd, there's still, you know, about a good 6 months before the election. And I think that in some ways, a lot of the public information campaign is probably going to be the holiday season in the first couple months in 2020. Generally speaking, when we think about elections, it's when they get close that the public really starts tuning in. So, again, our we have to, as a district in use of public funds, have to focus on public information as opposed to advocacies for and against. But I think that between now and October is when we're going to be identifying what is the important information, and some of the bullet points jump into that a little bit early. So I would hesitate on trying to establish an early, you know, call for a date right now. We just know what the deadline is, and we'll work through the timing as we move forward.
Another thing, I think that maybe board members can come forward at some point with different ideas and then discuss case by case. I mean, I have my card table idea.
Oh, yeah, like the corner card tables?
Yeah. And then another issue would be what kind of materials could we have for handouts? Say that the firefighters had a flyer just on the fire authority in general. Could that be handed out? I'm not talking about something specifically about voting or anything, but just in general.
Yeah, so public information, factual types of information is always good. And the idea is a well-informed public is going to make better decisions. But it even gets into issues that we don't want to say that when the special tax passes, then this is what's going to happen. The word when is being interpreted as being kind of pushing people. You say, if the special tax passes, then this is what's going to happen. So, again, we need to be focused on public information. And there's a situation, too, where as elected officials, you have to be very careful because you might have a card table at a farmer's market around the corner, and you have public information that's been provided by the agency. But then you start talking about advocacy. And the lines start getting pretty gray. Are you handing out public information, or are you using that public information and then starting speaking in an advocacy role? So, again, that's some of the discussions we want to have in more detail at a subsequent meeting on.
Like if there are signs, say, were we allowed to put, like, yes on or no on our yards? Or
my understanding is that's right. Everybody, you still have your freedom of speech. You can
so
put
we can be advocates, but we don't want to be advocates and handing out the OCSD.
And so I want to hesitate a little bit right now because, again, these are the good questions, but it's going to be the topic of what Jeff's going to lead us through at an upcoming meeting soon. Yeah, but again, I mean, the questions, again, you know, I have jotted a couple down. Yard signs.
You can hand out just straight information, pros and cons, something like that, and not say, you really need to, you know, just here's the information, make your decision as a board member.
And to me also, what are board members allowed to do independent from the functioning of the district and, you know, our development of public information?
Okay. I have another question before we go any further. Do we have any idea how much this election is going to cost? And is it going to be budgeted out of the general fund or out of the fire fund? Or because I think our board elections usually cost $5,000, so this would probably be a little bit more, wouldn't it? Just the actual cost of the election.
Yeah, you know, we can follow up with Tommy Gong on that particular question. We already pay for well, no, we won't, because the March election, you know, board members, your election is in the fall.
Yeah.
Right? Unlike cities and the county that will have participate in the primary. So normally we would not have a ballot item in the primary, and so we wouldn't have a cost to pay. Now we will, and typically our cost of participation is around $5,000. And I'm guessing it's probably going to be about the same, but I'll reach out to Tommy Gong in order to see if it's different when we put a ballot item on it.
So it's not a whole bunch more.
I can't imagine because, again, when your board is, you know, getting elected, that's a ballot item. It's costing $5,000 typically. This is a single ballot item. I don't know why it would be treated anything differently. So
should be less.
Well, I agree. It should be a lot less.
Yeah. Well, we can hope.
Okay. Next bullet, and this is where I took. So formal actions must be adopted by your board to place an item on the March 2020 ballot. And what I'm thinking about working with legal counsel on is that this is also a statutory, right? We were just talking about what are the legal boundaries that we have to operate within, public information, you know, statements of that go on the ballot. What are those types of the legal environment that we have to operate in? The formal actions is going to be a lot briefer discussion, so incorporate that into legal counsel's discussion as well, because simply that whole, the chart that the county clerk puts out is just by statute. It says you have to call for it, then there's so many days to develop the arguments in favor, and then people who are opposed have a certain period of time to develop arguments against. If your board calls for the election, then you have the primary right to rebut the argument against. And so there's specific deadlines and timing associated with the statutes there. So we'll review that as well during the legal counsel's review of the environment that we're working in. And that will give us also the, you know, a nice timeline between October and after October in order to identify critical dates after October 22nd. It's a process-oriented discussion there. So review of statutory requirements, all three slides, the first three slides here are about what's the law talking to us about. And so statutory requirements for divestiture of services and a presentation by the LAFCO's executive director. So I reached out to David Church, and he's agreed. We're targeting your April 24th meeting. April 10th is our next meeting, and Mr. Church is going to be out of the area. I think he's on vacation, but he indicated he could come on April 24th. And my thought is maybe that's what April 24th is all about, is legal counsel's discussion on those topics, and then have Mr. Church come in and talk about the environment for divestiture. And the other item, so as a really quick primer, we have to talk about divestiture in the event that the special tax doesn't pass. And how is it that fire and emergency services are going to be provided by the community? And not saying that divestiture is going to happen, but it's certainly a possibility, and it's similar to the dissolution of the Cayucas Fire Protection District. In the case of Cayucas, it was a dissolution because the fire protection was the only service that the fire protection, fire and emergency services, but they were a single-purpose entity. In the case of a community services district, divestiture means that the district's not dissolving, but there's a formal process sort of rid of an existing service. So if the special tax doesn't pass and we don't have the financial resources to run a fire department, how does divestiture work? And the basic idea is Oceano would be responsible for developing a plan of services. That plan of services then would be something that the county would take over through their relationship with Cal Fire. But you're not allowed to just impose it on the county. The agency who's going to be taking over the services has to agree to it. And then there's an entire process through the local agency formation commission that needs to be conducted. So David Church is the executive director. You know, he walked through the Cayucas efforts associated with the dissolution. He walks through annexations and changes in spheres of influence. This is his area of expertise. So I thought it would be best if David would come out and talk through, you know, the what if we find ourselves in a divestiture situation. And I think it's important to talk about early because that is part of public information. You know, the potential ramifications of yes and no votes are really part of public information, and we need to make sure we understand that well early in our efforts right now.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
But divestiture and success of the tax are not the only two ways we could go. Even if the tax failed, could there be a possibility of creating our own fire department or licensing to somebody else? Or so those are not the only two options we have.
Yeah, that's correct, and there's another bullet point that's coming up about options.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot harder to envision some of the other options, right? Obviously, Five Cities Fire Authority is here, it exists, it's providing community services. It's really easy to get our heads around, you know, the future of Five Cities Fire Authority. Cal Fire, County Cal Fire, currently operates. And so, again, that's an existing functioning organization that's easy to get our heads around. But those aren't the only two options.
Yeah.
What is the feasibility of being able to run a local department on essentially a little bit more than $1 million in revenues? How do we compare that to some of the other unincorporated community fire departments and what it's costing to be successful? The good thing is that a lot of that information is in the county report, where they look at the different fire and emergency services that are being provided in the different unincorporated communities. So we can look at how is San Miguel operating? How is Cambria operating? How is Templeton operating? Do they have operating models that might be feasible here? And if so, what would it mean in terms of service levels? So Five Cities Fire and Cal Fire County are the two that are going to jump to the forefront of our minds because they're good, operating, successful agencies. But it doesn't mean that they're the only ones or the only options. Service levels, you know, clearly are going to be significantly different under any of the other options. And so we need to make sure that we have good discussions on those so that the community has as good of information as can be provided as to, again, what happens sort of with a no vote.
Thank you.
So, again, so we're targeting the April 24th meeting in order to have really a pretty thorough discussion on legal environment, including the do's and the don'ts, you know, what's the statutory process of walking through a special election, and then what are the statutory issues associated with divestiture and the local agency formation commission. So now changing tune a little bit, procuring the services of a consultant to survey community preferences prior to calling for an election item. And I think that that's important and sort of the one thing that I would like to actually get an okay from your board today to go and talk to, for example, Grover has, in their recent election items, used a particular firm. They felt really good about them. I've gotten that reference. And I'm inclined to, you know, seek your board support to contact that firm because they know the local area. They've worked with Grover. I'm not sure about, you know, having a big RFP process and spending a few months in order to find somebody to do a survey. And I think that these local references are at least important for some initial outreach. The question then in my mind is that, you know, sort of why have a survey? And surveys provide a couple of different benefits. Specifically on like a special tax threshold, we might find that there's a threshold, a fiscal threshold, in terms of what the community might find acceptable. Also, surveys are really useful as a public information tool themselves. By asking certain questions in surveys, it helps to, stimulate the thoughts of the community in terms of what's going on and what are the options. And, you know, we have a relatively quiet public here in Oceana. We don't have packed rooms every meeting. In fact, we often, have light attendance. And surveys are really good, again, to start getting questions out there to the community, to stimulate questions from the community. And so in addition to being able to gauge the community's acceptability of certain maybe fiscal thresholds, the responses to surveys can also help us to understand what is the important public information that we need to provide to the community as a follow-up to the survey. And it looks like Director Rapogel might have a question.
Yeah. So at what point in time do you see putting on a survey? Because you can see if you do it fairly early, most people aren't informed on this issue, don't know what's going on. They hear raising taxes, and they're like, no. Or would it be later in the process when we've had an opportunity to get more information out there and people maybe understand the issue a little better and what the implications are of not passing an increase in tax?
So my thoughts are consistent with yours in terms of a question. What I'd like to be able to do is to get the firm in front of your board sooner as opposed to later and really help have them guide us on timing. They're the experts who do surveys, they could probably give us some pretty good input and guidance as to that particular timing, because I think our senses are probably the same. If we get out there too soon, it's going to be premature, but you can't wait too long either. So what is really
that's
good timing?
Timing?
And we're basically a year away, and that's where we know we've got a good window here. But specifically, when it's good to go do a survey, I just don't know the answer to that question, and would look for those experts to help us guide us on that.
Would that be something you could bring to the 24th meeting then, have them? Or would that be too much?
Well, if it's generally okay with your board, then, and I don't really even need formal actions because I'm not going to go and hire them.
Right.
But I can reach out to them and see, when would they be available and come and talk to your board.
So is that something the board?
Yeah, I was just going to ask the same thing.
Would
yeah.
be agreeable? Would you all be agreeable?
Yeah.
Then why don't
yeah.
we go ahead?
And we might even be able to get them here for the next meeting. I really don't know, but,
okay.
Rather than, some things I do based on my own initiative as a general manager, other things I want to make sure that the board is at least informally supportive.
We really do need to get the public start
getting
into, so like the 10th, maybe start getting it out there to come to the meetings that are coming up.
I have a question. Would the survey group, would they have information about owner-occupied houses and landlord out-of-town owners and how that might affect the vote or not?
Based on their experience in other communities, they might be able to explain to us some of the general dynamics that they see. I don't see them developing the demographic information. In fact, we've already started. We started that a year ago. We did our first pass at demographics, the number of we go in and look at the land use based on the county assessor's records, compare it to our water billing records. We really sort of, I would imagine that they're going to look at us to develop some of the demographic information. But based on that demographic information and what they've seen going on in other communities, they might be able to start educating us on what we might anticipate.
Won't this vote be for all registered voters, not just property owners, right? It'll be.
Yeah, that's what our discussion has been over the last year plus, is that.
That way everybody that lives in the community, instead of there's a lot of out-of-town owners, and they would.
And I don't know if it was 2013, 2012 or what, but there was the assessment effort that really did not work out very. And it was,
if you can get everyone that.
Right. So, and I have another bullet on that that we'll get into in a minute.
All right.
Okay. Next bullet is updated review of the strategic plan by the Five Cities Fire Authority Board of Directors with modifications as may be deemed appropriate. So one of the really good outcomes of what I just referred to as the Sunday ad hoc meeting of the agencies is that what do we really want to implement in terms of the strategic plan? And that question came up. So as a reminder, the strategic plan was adopted by Five Cities Fire Authority Board in the fall of 2017. I think it was maybe September 22nd, if my memory is serving me right. And then the Fire Authority Board went through this sort of a prioritization process, which says, how much of the strategic plan are we going to shoot and target to implement over the five-year period? Because like a lot of strategic plans, you just don't anticipate implementing everything. And so some of the feedback was, well, it's probably a good idea for now that the agencies have been engaged in looking at these issues to have an updated review by the Five Cities Fire Authority Board and sort of make a final determination on to the extent to which the feasibility, the strategic plan should be implemented. And one of the questions really is going to also come down to staffing levels, because are we going to have three crews at each of the stations? And so again, in talking with Chief Lieberman and the other city managers, we're starting to crunch some numbers on different scenarios, and that needs to get back to Five Cities Fire Authority Board, and we anticipate that to be in the near future as well.
Okay. Anybody have any questions?
With that, then, after an updated review by the Five Cities Fire Authority Board, we can anticipate that we're going to have updated cost estimates for OCSD share. And so we've got Excel spreadsheets put together. I originally developed them, have been working with Carrie. She's become up to speed on them. Carrie's participating in the meetings as well, because everybody's really got to be engaged moving forward. So after Five Cities Fire Authority has updated discussions, then we'll be able to develop some updated multi-year cost estimates for Oceano. Moving a little bit more into then sort of the options and more of the public information, we're really going to need to do a comprehensive review of the county report on fire emergency services provided by special districts, because that is going to be a source of some really good information and public information. I have a meeting scheduled with Chief Gelbert of CAL FIRE for next week, and part of that effort is I really need to make sure that I've done my homework and I know what's in that report. And so similarly, at an appropriate time in the near future, we really need to make sure that the entire board has developed a good understanding of what's in that report. And not just for Oceano again, but at least to some extent, what are the other unincorporated communities doing? San Miguel, Templeton, Cambria, or whomever.
I have a stupid... I don't think this is the time and a place for the question, but I'm going to ask it because I'm thinking of it. Sorry. Before we can have a tax election, we need to know, I feel, what it would cost Oceano and what kind of level of services could be provided by CAL FIRE. It's nice to have that county report, and I've read it a couple of times. But I would like more specifics so that I personally would like to compare Five Cities Fire Authority with what other potentials are out there before we even call for a tax election. And I don't know if it can be done, and I don't know if it should be done. But
well, I think it needs to be done, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean,
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
We need to have a comparison of all the
options.
I think
that's a question that people will ask.
Well, I think it's going to be equal cost is what I'm thinking.
Well, I would caution everybody to we think certain things right now, And that's always part of what we do and anticipating and read. And then sometimes we read something and we go, I didn't think about that. Wow, that's surprising me. When we're entering an election type of an issue, we really need to be cautious about our preconceived notions.
Well, yeah.
Because what we might say today gets picked up by somebody in the public, and then they run with it, or some people start believing certain things, and then we learn two meetings later that, oh, what I said was wrong. And meanwhile, there's a story that's being told within the community. So the thought here is, and again, have had discussions with Chief Lieberman, there's really two dynamics that I see going on with respect to county and CAL FIRE. One is they've provided cost estimates in their report. But that's under a scenario where they've developed this report that says, what if the local agency, the local special district, can no longer provide the fire and emergency services? What will the county and CAL FIRE face in terms of potentially need to pick up the ball? Well, under that situation where the county has already picked up a significant increase in cost for Cayucas, you've got to imagine that the county's not going to say, hey, they're going to come in here and give us level A services. That county report, as somewhat it's a risk analysis to the county, there's a bit of it where it's going to say, what's the minimum that we can get by with and serve the community? And so they're good numbers to look at, and yet they're probably not a good apples-to-apples comparison of service levels of county and CAL FIRE in comparison to Five Cities Fire. And so part of the discussions with Scotty, with Chief Jalbert, is, okay, you've got the county report in there, but what about meeting with Chief Lieberman, meeting with Five Cities Fire Authority, meeting with the city managers of Rio Grande and Grover, because the public's going to want to know an apples-to-apples comparison. I tend to be inclined to believe that Five Cities Fire Authority, when you look at the nuances, is going to provide a better level of service at something of a lesser of a cost. That's based on, you know, years of experience of looking at what does the state of California cost and somewhat of the, you know, the perception that the bigger the bureaucracy, the more that there's going to be overhead charges and miscellaneous costs associated with it. And, of course, we've heard already a lot about the service levels within Five Cities Fire and the individuals who work at Five Cities Fire and their knowledge of the communities and the neighborhoods and their ability to be really responsive locally, in contrast to the idea that those who are hired by CAL FIRE can be moved around to different stations or even to different areas of the state. We were never going to be able to come up with a true apples-to-apples comparison, but we've got to try to do a good job of saying, as terms of basic service levels, like if there's three levels, a shift of captains, a shift of fire engineers, and a shift of firefighters here in Oceano, what's our cost through Five Cities Fire Authority versus what's our cost through CAL FIRE, and try to develop that that apples-to-apples comparison, knowing that it's never going to be perfect, but then, you know, saying, okay, well, where do the differences lie? So, again, to rephrase that a little bit, the existing county report is good information, but we're not anticipating that it's going to be an apples-to-apples comparison to the strategic plan. So there's more work effort that needs to be done on that.
Thank you.
I had a comment on that. I think with the fire authority, we know what we're getting. We know the response times. We know how many men and all of that. With CAL FIRE, what would be the guarantees of what we receive? What would the response time be? I think all of that's unknown. So that's what I'm looking at.
I think the comparison needs to be expanded a little farther. I've had a number of members of the community say to me, when somebody has a medical emergency, why do the firefighters come? Why can't we just have some little paramedics trucks, more of those around? Because most of the time it's medical issues anyway and not a fire. Why do we have these big fire engines? So that's what I've heard from a number of people in the community, and we need to get in front of those questions and have answers ready.
I think Chief Lieberman has some good responses for that. So maybe when he comes up.
And I think that is super important, right? Because we know that ambulance services are out there. We know that, you know, community after community after community, the first response is from your fire and emergency personnel. We know that fire and emergency personnel, the vast majority of their calls are for medical emergency responses and not actual fires. Why is the system set up in the way that it's set up? And those are the types of questions that, you know, pop to people's minds when they're looking, when they become engaged. And we have to have good, clear, and concise answers to those types of questions, because if we don't, then it adds to the people who vote no, right? I'm going to go back. Yes.
I think it's very important that we have the apples to apples comparison as soon as possible, because, like, you know, in our area here, there's a lot of people that are retired.
Mike.
They're retired, have health issues, and the response time is very important, and I know it's like it's excellent here in Oceano when I've used it myself. So if the community sees, you know, we get that apples to apples as soon as possible, and they understand that, yes, there's going to be a tax, but you're going to get very effective response times, the levels, the efficiency is going to be excellent, then they might just understand, you know, it's their life that's you know, at risk there. I think the community is, I'm very confident that they will vote to have an effective, efficient, local fire emergency services here.
Well, we know that community survey, Yeah.
It needs to be done now. Because if they just hear tax increase, it's going to be like, no.
I agree.
Yes. So hopefully the fire chief takes this into account and starts working on it now.
And we are. I know that this week he's been meeting with his finance person, you know, working on more numbers. So everybody's fully engaged right now. I have a lot of confidence in the team that's working on it. And this all led into this idea of identifying the community options for fire and emergency services, because we would really be doing the community a disservice if we just said, hey, this is a special tax in order to continue with Five Cities Fire. We know the success of Five Cities Fire, but to put out good community information is really relying on the community to look at the pros and the cons and the different options and then to make their decision. Community-based decision-making is often with elected officials, but not always. Right? Your board does not have the ability to impose a special tax. That ended with the adoption of Proposition 13 in 1976. That's when the voters of California said these decisions are for the people and not the elected officials. And so providing them with a good public information on options for fire and emergency services is going to be critical. We can anticipate, just based on what we already know, that we're going to have a really challenging situation if the fire tax doesn't pass. And one of the things that we need to be careful about in talking about different options is that, and recognizing that some of those options simply aren't going to be as good as Five Cities Fire Authority, if it's too easy to sort of try to paint a doom and gloom if the special tax doesn't pass. And what we hear then is people coming out and, using the words of, we're fear-mongering. And so we want to make sure that when we're talking about public information, we don't get into the tone of fear-mongering because it starts to deteriorate our credibility. It starts to sound more like electioneering, and we really have to you know, put out the best public information so the community can make a well-informed decision. But I've been involved in these where, you know, I've had people even, you know, tell me that I'm fear-mongering, and it's just a really easy perception to develop.
How many of these have you done?
Well, I've done fire tax ones, yeah, in Los Osos, and then it's pretty rare because most of the, you know, Prop 218 issues that I've worked on have related to water supply or wastewater projects. So it's one of the reasons why I'm glad Bob Newman is here today to help with the credibility for Oceano CSD. And already today, in a meeting earlier today, he educated me yet on another aspect of fire and emergency services. So, you know, in terms of working on election items, yeah, I've got experience, but my experience with you know, fire operations is pretty darn light. Okay, so then we moved here from general discussions about options and what's in the county report and the Five Cities Fire Authority's strategic plan and where are we going to finally target implementation of the strategic plan into now Oceano-specific discussions. And so review of options for special tax formulas. And we've been talking about special tax. The other option is to do assessments with property owners. And I've been sort of leading your board down the path that that was tried already a few years ago and had a really, really poor result. And it's hard to envision why that would change. Now, special taxes generally have the two-thirds voter requirement, and so that might seem more daunting. Yet special taxes are for registered voters and the people who are living in the community and the people who are going to, you know, really be receiving the services. But what kind of options exist for special tax formulas? And so what we're going to bring back to your board is we know we've got at least three communities. Los Osos has adopted special taxes on a number of different occasions. And in fact, outside of Los Osos CSD boundaries property, there's a zone of benefit underneath the county, which is called 9I, County Service Area 9I, and they've adopted their own special tax in order to buy services from Los Osos CSD, who is actually now contracting with the county to get services through CAL FIRE. But Los Osos is the one that in our county that has had the biggest history of success in special tax elections. It used to be called South Bay Fire Department back in the day, and it was simply beloved by Los Osos, and it's been continued to be supported in a number of different tax elections. So that's one example. How did they develop their tax formulas? Cayucas has had special taxes passed. They did not have their most recent one passed. What does the Cayucas formula look like? Cambria has had elections passed. Again, their most recent one did not pass, but they have had some success. What does their tax formula look like? And what other kind of options? So we want to really be able to provide a comparison of the different tax formulas that have been implemented in the county and talk to your board about what other options might exist. The general idea, though, is that one option is just to go with a single flat rate for our properties. Every single property pays the same. The other options, that, especially like when we look at the Los Osos option, is the tax formula differs based on what your land use is. So single-family residents will pay different than apartment buildings will be pay different. And generally speaking, if there is a tax formula that is based on land use, it will often be perceived as having more equity associated with it. And so that's why we want to make sure to look at some of those options as well. And then after looking at the special tax formulas, the tax analysis itself, because what does that mean in terms of a particular formula, how much a single-family home is going to be paying? How much is that apartment complex that has four units going to be paying versus an apartment complex that has eight units? Or how much are the different units at the mobile home parks going to be paying? Because at the end of the day, that's what people want to know. They want to know, how much am I going to be paying? And there's a little bit where, you know, our analysis on tax formulas and the other options, they'll hear, they'll want to see that, okay, there's some equity being pursued there. It's generally, you know, as fair as we can be. Nothing's ever perfectly fair. But at the end of the day, people are going to go, well, how much is it going to cost me And then that's what the tax analysis will provide, property by property, specific estimates. One of the things that we can also consider doing as we look at the county assessor's information on land use and compare it to our water billing information, and I've done this before too on something in Napomo many years ago, is we sent out information to every single piece of property that says, this is what we understand your land use to be. Is that correct? Let us know. And that way the quality control on that data really goes to the property owner. It's also a potential way of alerting them to the fact that, hey, this is real and there's an issue on the table. And so that's one of the options we can consider in sort of proofing the property-by-property information that's going to be important in developing the tax analysis.
Question. What is your timeline for this discussion and then decision for the tax?
Because
it seems like we can't really move forward on our informational informing the public until
we know
that.
Yeah, so in general, I thought that April would be the good month to sort of do the legal reviews, you know, get LAFCO to get legal counsel to provide the discussions, moving May into tax formulas. We really need to, if we do that, then we're prepped for when Five Cities Fire Authority does their final review of the strategic plan and we sort of get the final direction of what's going to be implemented in the strategic plan. Then we'll get those numbers from the multi-year estimates of what it's going to cost Oceano. And then with those numbers, we can start plugging it into the tax formulas. So again, the good news is that we already started working on that effort last year. Celia was working on it a lot. Carrie was working on it. So we're looking at, we have to pay the county a little bit of money in order to get that tax information. We want to wait to get the most current information, but we'll probably target getting that from them near the end of April and start setting up our spreadsheets and everything else like that for May so that we're ready to start putting numbers in once Five Cities Fire Authority gives us sort of the final direction. Generally speaking, June, July, I'd like to have all the numbers crunched.
Okay. So, just clarification. This would be that it wouldn't be just a flat situation where everybody would be asked to, that every property would be the same. We'd rate it differently. That's the most logical way to go at this point.
Yeah, it's subject to your board's, you know, future decision and everything, but my recommendations are to do a formula that addresses land use because it's the best way in order to be as equitable as possible.
Yeah, okay.
And I think my last one that has, again, some of these great pictures of Five Cities Fire Authority in action is, you know, the preparation of public information. So that preparation of public information is going to be going on even after the, you know, there's a call for an election, because we're going to continue to get questions in. Things like frequently asked questions are really great.
We're going to do that, right?
You know, that's some of what we talked
about.
That's
really important, yeah.
Information on the history of fire and emergency services in Oceano. When it first got started, there used to be the Fire Protection District, and it got folded into OCSD with the election in 1981. The history associated with Five Cities Fire Authority is going to be important public information. The history about, or the information associated with who makes the determination of how much property taxes we get, because there's this always a strong public perception that the County Board of Supervisors makes that decision on how much property taxes we get, and the answer is that's not true. It's based on state law. And so just like the sheriff operates under the penal code, the county auditor has to operate under, I don't know if it's tax code or it's originally called Assembly Bill 8 after Prop 13 was adopted. But the auditor works under state code when collecting property taxes to figure out how much goes to Oceano and how much goes to, you know, Templeton or whomever. And And really, you know, that type of information, again, is important because it always comes up as that, you know, or sales tax or transportation occupancy tax, because as special districts, we don't get any sales taxes. We don't get any transportation occupancy taxes. The cities do. But on the other hand, we don't have to provide law enforcement service either. We don't do land use planning at the CSD. So the cities get certain types of revenues that we don't get, but they also have other obligations that we don't have. And so being able to have some good public information that, you know, as you start talking about taxes and who gets taxes and how much, you know, what kind of responsibilities or services cities have versus counties versus special districts, and it's a pretty quick way to bore the public. So we have to make sure that it's really succinct and, you know, good information without going into too much detail. And then with that, any, you know, final questions, and that sort of summarizes the next steps, and there's a lot of them.
So let's recap. We're going to, like, on April 10th meeting, what will we have on there?
So I'm going to seek to see if the firm that does surveys would be available to come and meet with your board on the 10th.
And then the 24th.
Yeah, the other thing I can do just based on feedback here is to try to put together like a general schedule. Director Replogle asked, you know, chronology, and I mentioned some of this stuff has to be going on parallel paths. It's a little bit hard to be specific on dates, but I can still put together some sort of a general schedule of where I think we're going to be moving through, you know, the next several months. And I could do that for April 10th, as well as seek the survey firm. And then April 24th, David Church has already responded that he is available, and that should give Jeff enough time to, you know, get his material together as well. And so that can be a, you know, a good focus on sort of the statutes and the legal environment that we're working with.
Didn't you think we'll have, by end of being May, before we'd know exactly what the tax, the numbers?
Well, and then I think in May, what we can do is start talking about the formula and the options. But I'm guessing that's probably not going to be until June or July that we'll be able to actually show you cost on a per parcel basis. Because, again, we need Five Cities Fire Authority to do their final review. And
just because there is some misinformation out there on what it would be. And I just want, you know, what the cost. Someone's already saying what it's going to be online, so I just wondered if we could. We don't have that figure.
We don't know what the date is.
I've seen $150 per per parcel floating around somewhere.
Per year, I would assume, as opposed to per. Yeah. And
yeah,
so
I just want to.
Is that about right?
So I'm going to hesitate from saying right now, too, right? Because as soon as I would say yes, then all of a sudden, you know, that story would multiply 10 times, right? So I think that's probably the good thing about coming back at the next meeting and putting together a general schedule, right? Because then the idea is during discussions that your board members might have with others or, you know, overall, we can say, well, no, that hasn't been decided yet.
Right.
But we're targeting June or July in order to have a hearing on that particular topic.
Okay. That's what I want. Okay.
You okay?
You all right?
Okay. Right. I just...
Well, I was a little bit worried there for a second. We care about you.
I had one more question. Yeah, I was
worried. You're a little Jim.
We still care about you.
Go ahead.
Do we know if... I even hate to bring it up. The proposed funding formula is firm at this point. Do we know what the other communities are?
So I hesitated from bringing the funding formula forward today because we think we're really close. But again, after having the meetings with the cities and stuff, the managers and I and Lieberman, we really need to take a final look at it and see if we're settled on our recommendations. Part of me also is thinking that I'd like to be back to your board. We'd all like to be back to the elected officials relatively soon So that one is it's going to help with the Five Cities Fire Authority budget for next year. And ultimately, I kind of need to know if all the elected bodies are going to be good with the funding formula, because that's going to drive what our annual costs are, and it's going to drive what the ultimately what the tax analysis is and everything. So that is one of our priorities. We cannot afford to wait till October 1st to break out the funding formula. And I do think we're pretty close. But again, everybody's got to take another look at it and make sure we're, you know, comfortable with the final recommendations to the two city councils and your board.
I know the Five Cities Fire Authority is going to look at budget in April at their April meeting. I think the word is warned about that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else got anything?
I just have, you know, I've been to all the meetings. You know, we had the meeting on the Sunday, and I have a lot of notes. I wanted to make it the basic theme is we're better together, all the three communities. We started in 2010 because we needed to be together to get the best service we can, and that's what's happened. We have quality service with our firefighters. We have the best service that, you know, I feel very comfortable with the level of service and the professionalism of our firefighters. And so we have to stick together and do the best we can to keep the Five Cities Fire Authority together. Our station here is like one of the most important stations. It's a strategic location. And for calls to Arroyo Grande, our station gets to Arroyo Grande calls a lot faster because of our location. I mean, Oceano is a very, very important component of the Five Cities Fire Authority. And I think we just need to all stay focused and work towards keeping it together. Some of the things that came up, too, like what would happen, the divestiture is how that affects your ISO rating. People need to know on their fire insurance what would happen if the rating of, you know, your service levels, that's a big issue with fire insurance. So if we were to, you know, if this were to break up, then that would be a problem. I think the main thing is service and what we would lose if we didn't stay together. And this, our union, the service model has to be a good deal. Thankfully, Five Cities Fire is a good deal, and this breaks it down. This is a really good, I don't know if you have any more of these, if these board members would have this, the chart that shows. And I know the other, I've been to the meetings with the other, with Arroyo Grande and Grover Beach, and they all stand with us. We're all standing together on this. So I look forward to moving forward and
you know, I think that is the follow-up. I think that's a really good point of emphasis because, you know, as these issues are being discussed early and concerns are being expressed by a variety of people and elected officials, sometimes statements can easily be misinterpreted. And so during our Sunday meeting, we had a really nice discussion about Oceano doesn't want to be viewed, and we don't believe, you know, we're a liability to the other communities. And the other communities were pretty clear, as we've never called Oceano a liability, and I believe them. But sometimes the Q&A that can happen can sort of lead to some semantics and stuff.
Roy Grant, you know, that some of the people in the public were saying that Oceano can't afford it and they can't carry their weight, which is just not
right, and that was more
and
out
we
of...
We are a very important component, and we do, like I said, our station location is best, plus all our firefighters. I mean, they're the most professional, best firefighters I've ever, you know.
Right. And the elected officials from the cities were pretty clear that
they've never considered
Oceano to be a liability.
Right.
And so the idea that sometimes, you know, the public comment at different agencies can create storytelling again.
Right.
And it was really nice, and the information provided by the union was really good. But it was also nice to see at the subsequent Arroyo Grande meeting that there was a, you know, strong statements in support of all three communities.
So we stand with Oceano, and they all really support us in our tax, in our election. The other two communities are behind us and want to stick with us and support us so we can keep our five cities, our authority. So I'm optimistic that we won.
Can I make one more?
Yes.
I constantly answer the question of why firefighters go to a medical call and they take their truck with them. Mm-hmm. It's a real simple answer. That's their toolbox. Because they may be going right from that medical to a structure fire, and it might be your house. And you don't want them to have to drive one vehicle back to the fire station to pick up another vehicle. So they're taking the most optimum tool, the most optimum truck they have to do the most jobs. And those fire trucks have got all kinds of things on them that they might need, from a shovel to a tool that'll cut you out of a car to et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, that's the answer to why they take the trucks with them. Thank you.
We really do need the Cynthia's question about the ambulance. That comes up a lot. That's something we need to address. I think maybe, I don't know, Chief Lieberman, are you running to speak now?
No, both of us are.
Or did you?
Now the experts.
Yeah. Good evening again, Steve Lieberman. Vice President White pretty much stole my thunder, but let me give you a little more perspective. Before taking this position, I was the director for the county EMS system. So I had a pretty good idea of our system design and the resources that come into play every day. And I think what people don't realize is, and again, this I started with the Fire Authority in 2014, so my data could be a little old. But in 2014, at the high point of the day, there were 13 ambulances serving a county population of over 250,000 people. Those ambulances were transporting almost 18,000 people a year. So it's a very efficient system. It's very fluid, meaning that the ambulances are on the go all day long. The fire department has to respond because we're what's called the agency having jurisdiction. We're your first responders. We're your primary EMS providers. We don't have a guarantee where that ambulance will be responding from. Sometimes it's in Napomo. Sometimes it's at its base in Arroyo Grande, which is fabulous. Sometimes the unit's delayed because they're on the dunes with a four-wheel drive unit. Our folks have oftentimes been providing patient care for an extended period of time waiting for an ambulance. The ambulances coordinate very well. If our ambulance from Arroyo Grande is at one of our specialty care centers, a trauma center or the STEMI or cardiac center, units will move down from other areas to cover the South County. But again, there's a lot of flexibility that goes on, and that's why we respond to those EMS calls. Also, cardiac arrest with high-performance CPR that we have that has an amazing patient outcome as far as survivability and the quality of life folks have when they're discharged from the hospital requires a crew. It's also known as pit crew CPR, like NASCAR, because we need three firefighters plus two folks on the ambulance to provide that patient care for the best outcome. The Oceano Station has two people on the fire engine every day. There's times when there's a cardiac arrest in this district that Station 2 in Grover Beach is responding just to provide that needed manpower to take care of that patient, extricating someone. Sometimes people need to go to the hospital, and they're in a place in their home where two people in that ambulance cannot get them on a gurney or downstairs. So very important that we respond to medical calls. I had another note. I think I talked a lot about EMS calls and what we go. Oh, the squad concept. I think you were talking about, Director Rapogel, about smaller vehicles responding to the calls. I think Ms. White did a great job of answering that. Larger agencies will run squads because they have more depth in staffing, and what they do is high-performance dispatching. So certain types of calls, these squads are running all day long to be first out for medical calls, and then the larger assets are for traffic collisions or to back up the squad or to go to a fire. We're small, so we have to be prepared for that next call, and that's exactly why the fire engine is the preferred tool to take care of that, much less the majority of the communities in this county. I just wanted to share some perspective that Scott Jobbert, who's the county fire chief, and I consider him to be a friend of mine, shared in one of our meetings. And again, just to share information, not to take a position at all. But I think as we're going down this road of discovery as a group, we have to look at mission. And actually, Chief Jobbert did a great job of talking to us about mission. So to stay within the Five Cities Fire Authority, you're part of our mission, right? We're all in this together. We're better together. And our mission is focused on 10 square miles and 38,000 people plus our visitors. And not judging, because I love County Fire, Cal Fire, and Chief Jobbert, but if Cal Fire moves into the station, you now become part of the county mission. And that means has different impacts for you as far as resource management that Chief Jobbert's going to have to make those executive decisions about. So as we develop the public education campaign, and I say we because I'm part of this, I'm all in, we have to be really good about educating the public. And lastly, not as your fire chief, but as a guy that lives in the community just up the road here, I did work on an advocacy campaign for a street bond measure that was successful. So I have that perspective. When I'm not wearing this outfit, I'd love to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Lieberman. Is there any, are we ready for a public comment now? Is there anyone else want to give public comment on this item?
Thank you. And this is a number one issue for us, I think all of us. And so I have two questions, and they probably are going to be pretty open-ended. I'm Dave Leffler. I live here in Oceano, one of the concerned citizens. And I think my two questions are, how can we help to move this ahead and to be successful with Five Cities Fire and this whole area here? It's an important area. It's a beautiful area. And when can we help? Those are really kind of the two
questions
I have right now, because it looks like there's a lot that needs to happen, and we would love to assist.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
You can just follow our meetings and like come to the next meeting, April 10th. Just stay engaged, and we'd love to have you.
We'll be at the next meeting.
Thank you.
And President Austin, I think that's a good question also for me to work with legal counsel on, because again, we know that we're restricted in our ability to use public funds for advocacy, but in terms of distribution of public information, there's a lot of different community groups who can help with the distribution of information. And even as Director Gibson was talking about the card table concept, certainly we as staff are, it's permissible for us to go and meet with a variety of different groups, whether they're, I've got a date set with the Pismo Realtor Group, I think it's the end of May, where I got to go and talk about whatever, you know, I want to talk about, and of course my mind is already going to talking about Five Cities Fire Authority. So working with individuals who are interested in the community can enhance our distribution of public information and can open up opportunities for whether it's staff or your board members to have, you know, discussions with groups. Again, how we're all going to carry on those discussions, we need to be careful about.
Right.
But again, whether it's, you know, coffee shop discussions at one of our new local coffee shops or whatever, you know, getting support from the community to help with the outreach efforts is always a good thing.
There can be some, maybe some citizens can get together and form a community group that, you know, to go door to door.
Well, maybe we could have something at the melodrama, you know, if they're not
like
a vaudeville show.
Or
yeah,
or
no, I'm not thinking about a vaudeville show, but there's different
have
venues, right? The community center, we have a number of different assets in the community, and some people might be more interested in hearing a discussion, you know, at the melodrama if those owners are interested. So there's, we don't have to be confined in our thinking about where we're holding discussions on the topic. We just have to make sure that we're within the, you know, the lanes of the legal requirements that we don't.
Well, I'm sure a group like the Ocean Advisory Council can have a meeting and have a public meeting, you know, or like a special meeting for
that. Well, I understand individually we can have meetings.
Yes, and those living room meetings with elected officials and, you know, six people who are in a bunkle card group or whatever can be really effective meetings to help get public information out there.
Okay. All right, if there's no one else wants to speak on the Five Cities Fire Authority, then we will move back now. Does somebody want to, anyone want to take like a 5-minute break?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Newman, sir.
We'll take a 5-minute break and then. And we will start back on item 8, consent agenda items. Is there any public comment on the consent agenda? Seeing no one in the public.
Excuse me, Director Austin. I would like to pull item 8A, and I have just a general question on C.
Okay.
Oh.
Okay, so we will
it's
pull
on.
8A.
It's not working.
Ask the, go ahead and ask their question. On
oh, yeah. On 8C, I was just wondering, whatever database you're pulling that information from, is it possible to add a column to identify, like, what it's for?
You're talking about
the information.
On the check reconciliation register? Yeah. Is there, like a memo line? Like, what? Like if it's a stipend or it's for, you know, the electric
looking
bill
at the
or
page
whatever.
That gives the check and the check number.
Like
back.
On page 10.
You know, certainly we can look into it. So the reports are a standard report that prints out of our Tyler system, which is our big software package and everything.
I just wonder if that's like if is the information in there? Is it like recorded when you generate?
So we can look into what the options might be. That's not a problem.
Would it just be helpful? I think for me and probably for other directors when we're reviewing this to know what the purchase was for.
I can always call Tyler and see if that option's available.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so that's 9C. So you wanted to pull 9A. So then, do we have any discussion on 9B, 8B, and C then? Does anyone have anything?
What are we doing?
Cynthia has pulled 8A, the minutes of February 12th.
Oh,
off of the consent agenda, and so we are going to now vote on B and C. So if anyone ready to make a motion on B and C?
Make a motion we approve consent agenda items 8B and 8C.
Second.
Can we get a roll call?
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Villa?
Yes.
Director Rapogal?
Yes.
Vice President White?
Yes.
President Austin?
Yes. Okay, and then 8A now. Those minutes, would you like to?
Yeah, so there's a little typo in the agenda that should be the minutes from February 13th. But down on item 9B in those minutes, under the action, it says staff recommendations were approved with a revision to include social, economic, and industrial burdens. I know we talked about environmental justice, and I think it's important to have that term in there. So I would ask that we add environmental justice.
I'd concur with that change.
Okay. We all concur. So then we'll make is someone ready to make a motion on item 8A with the addition of environmental justice item 9B?
I move that we approve the minutes of February 13th with the addition of environmental justice under item 9B.
Second. Okay, can we get a roll call, please?
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Villa?
Yes.
Director Plogle?
Yes.
Vice President White?
Yes.
President Austin?
Yes. Okay, now we'll go back down to business items. 9A. I'll note, is there any...
President Austin, members of the board, 9A is a recommendation to approve edits to the bylaws to compensate committee alternatives to attend committee meetings for compensation. In the past, the district has only compensated the board member participating at the meeting. The edits today in front of your board would include the alternative as well. There's another item discussed in the staff report, and it's in regards to the two regularly scheduled meetings. If this is something the board would want to consider, we'd bring it back as a future agenda item or to your board at a future meeting. There would be modifications that would need to be done to AP so we could pay things on time, and that research would be done before we brought it back. So with that, if there's any other questions?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Okay, do we have any?
You can go.
Do you want to give a...
Yep, thanks, Jeff. I'll follow up on Ms. Cassiola's comments. There is also a handout that illustrates how many agencies, how many of the community services districts meet once a month versus two times a month. And the staff report sort of discusses the cost associated with, cost savings associated with maybe having one. Well, I wanted to have the general discussion with your board. You know, the recommendations on the bylaw amendments so that alternates also get paid for attending meetings. When we looked at the bylaws, it wasn't really clear one way or another. But we looked at what's the history of the district, and the history of the district was that the alternates were not getting paid. And yet we think it's important that, you know, if alternates are showing up to the meetings, then they're ready to act when they need to act. So we're supportive there. And I also talked with Mr. Gent at the Sanitation District because they don't pay alternates, and he might consider, you know, putting a similar issue on their agenda. But again, I think it's, you know, beneficial for alternates to show up, and that's sort of where we develop those bylaws. But with respect to, you know, one meeting or two meetings per month, after thinking about it a little bit more, the advantage of continuing to have two regular meetings scheduled each month is that there's certain activities that your board cannot have at special meetings. And if we keep with our two regular format, but we just recognize that we don't always have a business purpose to have that second meeting. We
so
canceled
we can
one.
Cancel it.
Yeah, and so maybe that's the better understanding is that we, you know, again, if we don't really have a need to have a meeting, then why should we? We know that in the immediate future we're going to have a bunch of meetings because of Five Cities Fire Authority,
well, that
right?
That was what I was going to say.
And we need to keep on track on that.
We want to keep.
So what it really comes down to then is the issue associated with accounts payable, because we go through this process where, you know, your board approves all sorts of accounts payable, and the reality is that it's all a pretty routine process. Now, we can come back with a resolution to modify it, because one of the problems if we only have one meeting in a particular month is that if we don't pay the credit card on time, we're going to be paying late fees. If we don't pay certain other things on time, we're going to be paying late fees. Now, and so I'm looking at the idea that a lot of special districts allow the processing of AP. On the other hand, the report that we bring back is still going to show all of the expenditure details. We might be able to generate a different report, like an expenditure report, rather than a checks payable report, in order to address the questions of Director Roplogel, which is, how do we get a little bit more information on what we're actually spending the money on? And so seeking a little bit of board feedback on maybe opening up again what staff is allowed to process through accounts payable, and then the two items that I would not want to consider us processing without board approval are consultant payments and contractor payments.
Right.
And consultant payments and contractor payments, we can clearly structure them in a manner so that we don't have to pay any late fees. With respect to consultants, the usual answer is we're just not going to pay you any late fees. That's an easy answer. In contracts and construction contracts, the general conditions and when we develop a construction contract usually establishes dates as to when they have to submit pay estimates and what our turnaround timing is. And in construction contracts, if we don't pay in a timely basis, then yeah, we are subject under certain legal requirements that we have to pay late fees in there or interest charges. But when we go out of a construction contract, we can set the timing of when they have to give us the pay estimates so that it can be coordinated with board dates. And so again, you know, we have a lot of routine expenditures that in all cases, just like we do today, we would be reporting to board on what we've paid. We would still be looking for board members to actually sign the checks. Small district like this, I don't want to have staff doesn't have any authority to sign checks. I think that continues to be important. But if your board is willing to consider the ability that we don't have to process accounts payable as we're doing it right now, I think it provides opportunities for some efficiencies. You can't take that action today, but if you're generally open to it, then we can work with legal counsel and try to update the resolutions that we have and bring it back for additional board consideration.
Before we get too deep into discussion of going to one meeting, could I get confirmation that it was properly noticed to discuss? Because it's not listed in item 9A that only addresses edits to the bylaws to compensate committee alternates for attending committee meetings. It doesn't say anything about reducing down.
Right, and I think you're right, and I believe what Mr. Rogan was saying is that he's just trying to get a general sense of whether or not your board is interested in having that being brought back to you as an issue.
Okay, so we're not really going to discuss the going to one meeting tonight. It's just like more informational at this point?
Right.
Okay. And maybe we could take the two things separately, the alternate compensation and then the
yes, because those are the formal actions that are being recommended.
Well, okay, yeah, so the formal action is consider a recommendation to approve edits to the bylaws to compensate committee alternates for attending committee meetings and to approve a related director stipend of $50. So is that two separate things?
It can be done with one motion to approve staff
okay.
recommendations.
So I would like to address that since I think it was me claiming a stipend for attending the South County Sanitation District meeting as an alternate, claiming a stipend for that instigated this. I would recommend that if we make an adjustment to the bylaws, it be to state that an alternate will be compensated if the primary delegate is unable to attend or if the alternate is directed by the board to attend, as I was directed by this board to attend the sanitation district meetings in case Director Austin had a conflict and I would need to be available.
So under the current bylaws, if an alternate is attending in lieu of the primary, then you do get the stipend. So that's okay. Already addressed. And so I guess what I'm hearing, Director Oplogle, is you're saying that the alternate would only get a stipend if their attendance is directed by the board?
Right.
Which is more restrictive.
If they're attending in addition to the primary representative.
That's, you know, it's more restrictive than what our recommendations are, but certainly it's what your board pleases.
Do you have something?
Yeah, I think that I have a problem with that in that, you know, the agenda is known ahead of time, so President Austin knows whether she would need to recuse herself or not. And the other issue, the sanitation district and Zone 3, and I don't know about other committees, but those are televised or they're on slow span. So I think there's an opportunity for any alternate to view those for free and then not come back and ask $50 of the district. I think that's unfair to the district.
My understanding was that this board directed me to attend all sanitation district meetings. Was I incorrect in my understanding?
I don't remember.
I don't remember that.
I kind of halfway do.
I sort of do.
Yeah.
So are you saying that you recommend or you strongly suggest that we attend so that we are informed so in case someone's absent, we know what's going on?
So I'm not strongly recommending anything on this particular item. What we're doing is addressing the fact that the existing bylaws lack clarity. If an alternate attends a meeting, it's not clear in the bylaws as to whether they should receive the stipend or whether they shouldn't. We just know that the history or the practice of the district is that the alternate does not receive the stipend. So now what we have is a discussion of if the alternative is, you know, directly either suggested, it doesn't even need to really be a formal motion or whatever, but if it's sort of like we think the alternate should be attending the meetings, then the stipend, you know, should be paid. That's one option that's in front of your board. We were recommending the idea that it would be the alternate's discretion, but to encourage participation and to encourage attendance, then, you know, our recommendation is we thought it should be allowable. Certainly, again, that's not a strong position or anything, but it's aligned with, you know, engagement. Director Gibson's thoughts on the ability to view, you know, meetings on the internet or whatever is certainly a valid perspective. I think that you pick up a little bit more when you're actually at meetings, but staying in tune with what the issues are can be accomplished in alternative ways. So if your board takes no action, then our interpretation of the bylaws will be that alternates do not get paid. And then you have the options of, under Director Oplogle's suggestion, one is, you know, if it's either encouraged or whatever by the board for whatever reason, then it would be paid. Or under the basic staff recommendation would be that it's permissible and it's the discretion of the alternate.
Well, was there...
I would support just that alternates attend at their own discretion and leave it at that, and that money should not be a part of that. No stipend.
That's what I think. If an alternate would like to go to the meeting, I think that's fine. But there are you can watch it on TV. You can get the minutes. You can find out what's going on. I don't know that we recommend it. I don't remember it. I mean, did we vote? if we voted to send her, did we, the bylaws at that time did not state there was a stipend? I mean,
yeah, even if there's not a formal vote, you remember, when you're in your sessions like this, you do have the ability to sort of give informal direction, and that may have been a reasonable interpretation by Director Roplogel at that time. Those are two different issues, though, because on the one hand, your board could decline to make any changes to the bylaws, and you could still take number two as a singular issue and approve the one stipend, and then set the tone on how we're going to work in the future. So I think the question was posed to me, do you take them together or you take them individually? And you can certainly take them up as two different questions as well.
Well, I'd make a motion that we pay the one stipend, but in the future that there would be no stipend for alternates.
I'll second that.
Director,
further discussion.
Question. How will that affect other meetings that I attended under the board's direction?
What do you mean?
I mean, I attended
other... You want to put
other,
in more stipends, you mean?
I believe I put a meeting down on that form I gave you. So I attended the Sanitation District meeting earlier this month. And I would also like clarification if the board still wishes me to attend all of those meetings. Or if it is optional.
I would consider it optional.
Optional.
So I think the stipend we get, the $100 for each meeting, is enough to cover if you want to go to another meeting. Some meetings last a long time. Some are very short. Kind of all balances out. I don't think it's necessary to pay more money for an alternate to go to another meeting if they want to. I think that's fine. That's the way it's been since the beginning. No one's ever expected to get paid for...
Well, I'll go back to my motion that we approve this $150, and then anything after this, no.
So a question of clarification for Director Pogel, because we know that I knew that you had the one request in for attendance at an alternate, as an alternate for the South County Sanitation. I guess the did it happen the second time then as well?
Yes, I...
Okay.
So under the board's direction, which... half of the directors recall, I have been attending as a mandatory direction of this board all of the South County Sanitation District meetings and claiming a stipend. So I believe that's two meetings in total as of this date.
Okay. So what might be appropriate under the idea of what has happened so far versus how your board might want to proceed in the future is there's a motion and a second on the table. The question is, would the maker and the second be open to a friendly modification to cover the second meeting as well?
Yes, I would.
I would second. Agree. Yeah, I would second that.
And just to clarify for me, I've only heard from two of the directors who do not want it to be mandatory for me to attend the Sanitation District meetings.
Yeah, I think that what we have to do is address the motion that's on the floor first and then address the subsequent question that you have as to whether it's the board's preference to sort of, as you're characterizing, mandate you to attend the meetings.
Okay.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second. You do a vote?
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Villa?
Yes.
Director Roplogel?
Yes.
Vice President White?
Yes.
President Austin?
Yes. Okay, now you want to address order to attend the... I think that what we said is if you want to attend the meetings, feel free. But I don't think there should be a stipend.
We don't think it should be mandatory.
Then it shouldn't be mandatory, only no. If you want to, you know. Because, like, I just leave it up to your discretion is the way I think.
I mean, I think it's mandatory for us to attend all the meetings that we're assigned to, and then as alternates, that's, you know, up to each person individually.
Okay.
Do we need a motion?
I'd just like to hear from Director Villa and Director White.
I don't think we need to.
The meetings that we're supposed to go to, I think that we should do that. It is our responsibility if we're able to go to do the best that we can to attend those meetings and get a stipend for that. But when you're an alternate, and the way it's always been that you don't get paid if you're an alternate, then
only if you sit at the meeting. If you do take the seat, of course you would get paid.
You get paid only if the person's sick or on vacation, type of thing. Then you'll get paid, right? But if you don't, if that's not the case, then you don't get paid, and it's up to you voluntarily wise. But if the board suggests it or recommends it, then I think you should get paid. That's my opinion.
That's the understanding I was going on, together with the input that I had received from the board that I needed to go to the meetings. So if you all don't think I need to go to the meetings anymore, then I will no longer consider them mandatory. Thank you.
But
frees up some of my Wednesdays.
Yeah, but in the future, like if someone wants you to attend and you're willing to attend, then you should get paid.
So legal counsel
That's
sort of brought this. Let's turn our attention then to page 22 of 70, and it's provision number 8 under director compensation. And we have the red line in there that would have added the language, as the appointed board representative or as the alternate. Now, right now we have no changes to the bylaws, which sort of still leaves this subject to interpretation. And what might be beneficial here is to articulate how we want to read, because the portion that says as the appointed board representative seems like there's no controversy there, right? If you're the rep and you go, then you get paid. The question is, or as the alternate, if in lieu of the appointed representative,
or as the alternate serves as the in the absence of
the appointed representative. And then the question becomes, what if the board formally directs the alternate to attend? Because
then they should get, if it's a formal, and if it's a vote,
then they should
get a formal
compensation.
You must go, then yeah. So you can add that in, I think. Then.
So I had written some proposed language. An alternate will be compensated only if attendance of the alternate at a committee meeting is required because, one, the appointed representative is unavailable to attend, or, two, the board has directed the alternate to attend.
Excellent.
That works.
Sounds right.
For clarification, where would that language start?
Including your proposed language, it would be a new sentence.
So maybe you can state that in the terms of a motion, and then so as it's currently written, the bylaws end with the phrase "attended by him or her," period. And so the language that you're proposing would start after that period. What we're looking at,
would it make sense to just start it right after that? You think, does it just clarify the phrase that you added at the end there?
Maybe read your language again.
An alternate will be compensated only if attendance of the alternate at a committee meeting is required because, one, the appointed representative is unavailable to attend, or, two, the board has directed the alternate to attend.
So you're saying leave the entire red line in, or is the alternate? The alternate will only be compensated if.
Yes. Yeah. Does that make sense?
It's a clarifying statement of when the alternate gets paid, so yeah.
I have a question, though. Have we ever done that before? Have we ever needed to do that?
Well, I think what happened is we got pretty close on it, right? And the direction that Director Rapogel believes that she receives, and there was some concurrence about that. was probably more the informal direction. And so what we're doing with this clarification is saying that it has to be formally directed, which would require a motion and a vote of your board.
So there's no way we could make it simpler in just stating that the board representative or whoever chairs that night, whoever is in attendance?
Well, it would cover both of them. It would cover the situation when the alternate is attending in lieu of the primary, mm-hmm. and it would also cover the situation, which is going to be few and far between, when the board formally directs the alternate to attend. And what it would do is eliminate, you know, there's no informal direction, right?
Mm-hmm. But, excuse me, can I speak?
Sure.
But in the past, there has been informal, and I'm looking at the fire board, informal discussions between the primary and the alternate, suggesting that the alternate come to the meeting.
But that's a discussion between the primary and the alternate, and it doesn't fit the conditions that Director Replogle laid out.
Okay.
It's within the board's discretion, but again, if there... Okay, more questions?
I think that we just have to be more careful with our words in discussion.
Well, and that's the benefit of requiring formal direction.
Right.
So you want to make a motion on
So I move that we accept the proposed addition language in bylaw section 8.1 and add a sentence that reads, an alternate will be compensated only if attendance of the alternate at a committee meeting is required because, one, the appointed representative is unavailable to attend, or, two, the board has directed the alternate to attend.
Second.
Okay. 2 seconds.
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Villa?
Yes.
Director Replogle?
Yes.
Vice President White?
Yes.
President Austin?
Yes. Okay. Uh-oh. It's doing so good. We got that taken care of with my agenda. Where did it go? So we're on 9B. Consideration of recommendations to include estimates in the preliminary 2019-20 budget for the cost of live streaming services for board meetings to obtain design build proposals to upgrade audio visual equipment and receive an update from the social media ad hoc committee.
Pretty quick staff report here. We met with AGP. Their cost for live streaming is $200 a meeting. That does provide the ability for anybody to go on slow span, pull up the meeting, pull up audio, visual. I especially like the idea, considering all the discussions we're going to have on Five Cities Fire Authority. There is a cost associated with it. But all things considered, I think that the benefits are there. The second item about soliciting proposals for upgrading the audio-visual equipment is really the sound system, moving away from screens. We pay AGP, I think, $75 a meeting when they bring audio, when they bring the laptop, the projector, and the screen, and we can set up our permanent and have a better, yes, that's an additional service.
You could buy this stuff for a lot less
than that. Don't use it often, but the point is that with upgrading our audio-visual, we have the ability to, the county's public education and governmental funds will pay for the equipment, but they don't pay for installation. And in the general discussions with AGP, total cost should well be within the public contracts code to get informal proposals from the different outfits that do this locally. One of the other benefits about upgrading some of the equipment is if we move, we don't do it very often, rarely have the bilingual translations, but the type of equipment that will help with bilingual translations isn't the type of equipment that we could use with our what is becoming sort of antiquated audio-visual stuff. So it will have you know, provide us with better abilities to, you know, televise or have our meetings streamed and higher quality of service. On that issue of obtaining some proposals, there's no financial commitment by your board at this point in time. It would be a pretty easy process to get some proposals in and come back to your board and see what we're going to get, and then you got to make a decision on whether you want to do it or not. But essentially, those are the two items here. Is, you know, the streaming services cost $200 per meeting. An upgrade to our overall audio visual is going to be much more expensive, with the actual equipment cost being funded through reimbursements from the county. But we'd have to pay installation costs.
So, speaking as a member of the ad hoc committee, I'm not sure this issue is really ripe yet. I don't feel like we've explored all of the options, some of which would be lower cost. You know, there's a lot of technology out there that we could get versus using AGP, great as they are, that might reduce the amount that we have to be spending on this. So I don't really feel ready to commit to adding it to the budget that we're going to do this or anything like that.
Shirley or
well, Ellie? if we go to less meetings, we'll save some money there, right?
Well, yeah, I think it's in order to do live streaming. Mm-hmm. I think that yes, less meetings is going to cover those costs pretty readily. The cost associated with upgrading audio-visual is a different situation,
yeah.
And the installation costs would have to really come out of reserves. But in terms of options, you know, again, if the social media group wants to, you know, investigate options, that's good. I'm not really seeing a lot of options. I'm not seeing a lot of service providers other than AGP. I'm not seeing staff being able to provide the services that if we upgraded equipment, we don't have the capability of actually, you know, running it and doing the stuff that AGP does. So
yeah, I don't think we'd want to involve staff. That would be too much.
I mean, we could provide live streaming just by setting up a video camera somewhere. It wouldn't switch to show different points of views. It wouldn't be linked to the agenda, but well, I'm saying that's another option. And what I would like to see, what I was hoping would come out of the ad hoc committee, is an assessment of various options and the benefits and drawbacks of each, and then we could consider them and make a decision.
So,
on the board.
Okay, you know, it's a fair thought. I don't see staff doing that work. So the question becomes is when is the ad hoc committee going to do those investigations and come back and report to the board? And in overall cost implications, when we've got, you know, a $4 million budget, I don't really see the AGP services or what we're talking about as being a significant component of the budget. There is a cost of being able to televise, and even if there's marginal differences on costs, I think that having a camera that's just generally following the board meeting without the professionals there is to, you know, be able to move around to who's talking or to show the PowerPoint slides, I think we would be compromising the quality at a cost decision that's really nominal in comparison to the overall budget.
Well, if cost is not an issue, then I strongly oppose going down to one meeting a month to save that money in order to pay for this.
Well, and look, the recommendation was not to go down to one meeting a month in order to provide for live streaming. The discussion of having less meetings is just the cost associated with the meetings and the overall efficiency and effectiveness. When we have two meetings lined up, we'll finish a meeting on Wednesday night like this, and immediately the next Monday we're starting to work on staff reports for the next meeting. We have a lot of items that get into business discussions that could realistically be dealt with on the consent agenda. And what we're finding challenge, where I'm specifically finding challenge, is when I'm spending too much time focusing on board meetings and not doing other things that are really the functions of the district and trying to get our work done. So the idea that going to one meeting is a hard rule, I've already stated that that's not a good idea. Maintaining a two regular meeting schedule, but recognizing that we simply don't need to have meetings every single, you know, twice a month. And having meetings for the sake of having meetings isn't a really cost-effective thing to do either. So those are two separate issues. This issue associated with live streaming is certainly, in terms of the overall budget, a pretty nominal item. The cost savings are separate that can be achieved. So we need to separate these.
You'd link them together in these items, so that's why I was mentioning it. But I don't see how you can say we're having meetings for the sake of having meetings. It's not like we're getting together for an hour and we don't have anything to talk about. We've been here for 3 hours already, and our meetings typically run long. So condensing that down in half, I don't see how that's possible.
I think but that would be
that's a discussion for another meeting.
Yeah, at the discretion of the general manager, if he thought there was, I think he would know if there was something we really needed to have a meeting on. And if not, then
we didn't finish this discussion. We went from the stipend right into the audiovisual, and I don't think we really had a
discussion.
I want to
get straight on what we're doing here because we're getting.
Okay.
Are we going to vote on streaming service? The streaming, is that something that we're supposed to vote on here?
Point of order. It's 9:00. Our bylaws say we have to continue the meeting.
Is it 9 or 9:30?
I thought it was 9:30.
It's 9:30.
Is it 9:30? Okay.
I just looked it up. I thought it was 9 o'clock.
9:30.
Okay, so
we're cool.
So let's get back. What are we doing? Are we going to decide if we want to do the live streaming? It would be $4,400 annually, plus a one-time setup fee of $250. So let's talk about, do we want to do the live streaming? No. Or is this something we're going to bring future?
So first off, the specific agenda item is, do you want us to include the cost of live streaming in next year's budget estimates? Presumption then is that what would happen would start on July 1st. And so if you want to include it in the budget estimates, then recommendation number one, then I'll point you to recommendation number one.
Could I ask a question first?
Yes.
Would it behoove us to move forward with live streaming ahead of that time? I'm looking at the fact that on April 24th, we're going to have a whole bunch of stuff on fire, Five Cities Fire Authority. Would it benefit us to have some of that stuff going live to the community prior to next year's budget, or is it too expensive to, or is it not covered on the budget and we'd have to do a budget transfer?
I think that might be addressed in two separate motions. The first motion would be, you know, are you going to provide direction to include it in next year's budget? The second, to start live streaming earlier, is kind of outside of the bounds of this agenda item. And on that point, I think you would direct us to bring back an agenda item so that your board can consider live streaming sooner than July 1st.
Okay, I make a motion that we direct staff to include the cost for live streaming into the preliminary 2019-2020 budget.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Can we get a roll call vote, please?
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Villa?
Yes.
Director Replogle?
Yes.
Vice President White?
Yes.
President Austin?
Yes. And then I have a question. Years ago, or the few years ago, when we were watched the meetings after, you know, we would see the meetings. Now it's only audio. When did that change? Do you know what happened?
I'm not aware. Ever since I've been associated with the district, we only have...
It's been audio?
It's
it used
only
to be,
been audio.
You remember, it used to be... You could watch the meeting.
On slow span.
Yeah, they show the meeting. It only goes to audio after a certain amount of time.
They show it.
It's always audio.
On slow span. On charter, there is a schedule where your board meetings are aired.
Right, so slow span is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I'm only aware of the audio.
Oh, okay, so charter 21, when you watch when you watch it on TV, it'll show.
Right.
That's might be where I saw it then.
So what about the 60,000?
Well, I have TV. What was that, Sherman?
TV.
The 60,000, are we?
I don't know what. I'm not. The cost of the auto visual. What is actually $60,000?
Equipment.
Yeah, well, it's the equipment and the installation, and the idea is in talking with AGP, they have some basic recommendations to improve, and rather than having screens, have more of the flat screens up there, some changes to the audio in order to make the sounds sound better. But the idea is there's a limited number, a few different outfits that actually do these upgrades. And the question is your board interested in getting a proposal to see what type of upgrades might be considered and what the cost might be?
One other suggestion AGP had was putting stick-on acoustic tiles on the ceiling, because this room is very echoey, which is one of the reasons that people who are hard of hearing have trouble understanding what people are saying, because there's so much reverberation. And the ceiling tiles, from what I understood, were actually not very expensive as an upgrade.
Yeah, that's my understanding, too. And sort of the point of getting the proposals in is so that we would really know what the options are and how much they would cost.
So I'll make a motion that we authorize the general manager to solicit proposals for upgrading the audiovisual equipment at a cost not to exceed $60,000.
Second.
Can we discuss so you're just going to get bids, because this sounds like a lot of money.
We're going to
go out and get. Well, we'd still have $30,000 in costs to the district.
So it's hard. It may not even be that much, but we have to know how much is equipment versus how much is installation, because the installation costs we would have to pay for.
Some investigation.
Yeah, we'd get formal proposals from people, and then your board can decide whether or not you want to do it or not.
We're not buying it tonight. We're just
it just sounded like a lot of money.
So there is a motion and a second on the floor.
So you want to go ahead and call.
And then to verify the second, it was Director Villa?
Yes.
All right, roll call. Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Villa?
Yes.
Director Oplogle?
Yes.
Vice President White?
Yes.
President Austin.
Yes.
Okay. So whether now or under future agenda items, I think the question is the one that Vice President White brought up is, do you want us to come back with an agenda item at the next meeting so your board can consider whether you want live streaming before the end of the year?
Yes, I think we want to put that on the... Yes. I think we're all in agreement there.
Yeah. Okay.
President Austin,
yes.
Could we discuss the one or two meetings a month, or did we close that?
We can go ahead and we're going to bring it back.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
I think
I don't want to discuss it.
Why don't we hit on that topic a little bit when we move to future agenda items?
Okay. All right. So let's move on to item 9D, right? Is that where we're at now? I've lost my agenda.
Yes.
And that's back to your business and accounting manager, Ms. Cassiola.
President Austin, members of the board. Item 9D is a recommendation to review the general audio and other liability insurance coverage for the year 2019. Our coverage goes from April 19th, and it'd be April 2019 to April 2020. So that's why it's before your board right now. Staff received two quotes. One is included in the board package that was provided. The other is a handout here from SDRMA, which is the Special District's Risk and Management Authority, and it was received later, as your letter stated. The district has been with CalMutuals. The proposal that was provided in your agenda for the past 2 years, we switched in 2017. Staff has been pursuing a quote from SDRMA for the past 3 years, and this is the first time they've quoted us. You can see it came in high. It was at over $44,000, while the CalMutuals is at $23,000. So staff recommendations will be to go with the $23,000 and remain with CalMutuals. And if there's any other questions, I can field them at this time.
I had a question on page 64. It says flood and earthquake coverages are excluded. Do we have flood insurance somewhere else? Because we're in the floodplain, right? All the facilities here?
No. Our facilities are just outside of the floodplain.
Just outside? Okay.
Okay, does anybody have any questions of staff?
No.
Any public comment on the insurance item before us? Okay, so is anybody ready to make a motion?
I make a motion that we accept the offer of Allied for general auto and other liability insurance coverage for 2019 and authorized payment in the amount not to exceed $23,727.
Second.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Can we get a...
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Vieth?
Yes.
Director Oplogel?
Yes.
Vice President White?
Yes.
President Austin?
Yes.
So the motion covers recommendations number A and B. Recommendations C and D need to be addressed based on the timing of the need to procure the insurance, the recommendation to, you know, authorize me to execute insurance documents, and a check disbursement, you know, in the amount of $23,727. Are also necessary in order to move forward with this item.
We need to say it, do another motion.
You can say, approve staff recommendation C and D, and that would cover those two items.
Make a motion to
approve. I make a motion to approve staff C and D.
Second.
Shirley seconded.
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Villa?
Yes.
Director Plogle?
Yes.
Vice President White?
Yes.
President Austin?
Yes. Okay, that brings us to item 10. Any hearing items? None. Any written communications?
No.
Late received written communications?
Nope.
Future agenda items?
So with this respect to the discussion about one agenda item versus two, to clarify some of my previous comments, I do like the idea of having two regularly scheduled meetings, even if we find ourselves not needing to have a second meeting in a particular month. And that's because there's things that you cannot do in special meetings. But under the idea that there may be situations where we only have to have one meeting in a month, we still have to address the accounts payable issue. So if it's the board's desire to be able to consider the option of just having one regular meeting a month, then the future agenda item is really going to have to address how are we handling accounts payable. And then
how do we do it in the months like December where there's normally one meeting?
It can be difficult. Yeah, and we've had... Like this last December, we ended up having two meetings. In December also, we ended up having a special meeting. But still, that's what the focus is. If your board wants to consider that, then we'd really be coming back with recommendations associated with accounts payable. And again, all things that we spend is reported to your board. So to me, that would be the shape of a future agenda item if that's what your board wanted to be able to consider.
I think we need the flexibility to do that. Have one meeting, I have two meetings, so however that needs to be figured out, I would support.
I would too.
We're still going to end up writing all the checks. And
right. So you're saying we could have one or two meetings? Well, not one or the other, huh?
Well, we'll schedule.
Well, yeah, the bylaws will still say that we can, you know, you're set up to have two regular meetings. With a change in accounts payable, it allows us to have just one meeting. If that's, and we know that's not going to be in the immediate future because of, you know, all the discussions on Five Cities Fire Authority.
So you see this as like a cost-saving measure too, because each meeting, if we're not having a full agenda, then we are still paying for legal counsel and staff to be here. That's
well, and the processing of the, so there's no savings on the actual creation of the agenda items, right?
No.
Because whether they're on one meeting or the next, or whether they're regular right. business items or on the consent agenda, right. That's still true. But there is an extensive effort associated with the compilation of everything, mm-hmm. the creation of the agenda, and staff time. And that's what, you know, Carrie had developed and worked on mm-hmm. in terms of those cost implications. Okay. And I agree that I confused the issue a little bit because of the live streaming topic. There's no doubt about that. It's almost like one thought led to another, but they are separate thoughts. Yeah. So I
like the idea of being flexible then.
So you'll put that on another agenda then?
Yes. About the accounts and it'll be a business item, not a consent agenda, so that there's good discussion.
And then
on
we're going to do the fire. And
just thinking that it would also assist in November and December, where we ran into the problems last year.
That is correct.
We did the fire.
So do we have any future, anything else we need to?
So this is not a future agenda item, but just a request for future agendas. If you could try to estimate how long we'll be in closed session, if you could put that
on the agenda.
It would provide more clarity for members of the public in terms of when they need to show up here. We want to be respectful of the community's time. Thank you. And I also wanted to clarify something that I said at the last meeting. I referred to someone as a bad actor. The definition is an individual with a criminal conviction. So that was a perfectly true and accurate statement. Slander is a false spoken statement damaging to a person's reputation. So I did not slander anyone.
We're ready to adjourn? Do we need a motion?
I shall move.
Second. All in favor? We're adjourned.